This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
But the thing is that to enforce an imperial agenda, you scrap the republic. Now, Julius Caesar understood that perfectly well. I can't remember the exact quote, but he said, you don't build an empire with a republic. And I think that, in effect, what's happening is that the republic is being scrapped. It's not only being scrapped in France, it's being scrapped in America.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Michelle Chosadovsky. Today's show, State Terrorism, Franco-American Style. Michelle Chosadovsky is an economist and is the founder, director, and editor of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. He is the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, America's War on Terrorism, and The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. Today we discuss his most recent articles on the alleged ISIS terror in Paris, as well as the Radisson Hotel terror in Bamako, Mali, a former French colony. We analyze current state-sponsored terror in general within a larger global geopolitical and economic framework. Michelle Chosadovsky, welcome.
I'm delighted to be on Guns and Butter.
On November 13th, 2015, shootings and suicide bombings were staged in five different locales in Paris, the capital of France. 130 people were killed. Less than a week after the Paris gun and suicide bomb attacks, a group of heavily armed gunmen stormed the Radisson Blue Hotel in Bamako, the capital of Mali, a former French colony, in which 21 people were killed. There have been a string of recent high-profile terror attacks, from bombings in Beirut and the downing of a Russian airline over the Sinai Desert. Where do you think we should begin in trying to address all of these recent terror attacks?
I think there's a fundamental contradiction in the official narrative, both of the United States and, of course, of France and its allies. The United States is leading a war on terrorism, which is directed against the so-called Islamic State, yet the evidence amply confirms that the Islamic State and the various al-Qaeda-related terrorist organizations are creations of U.S. intelligence. They're what are called in intelligence parlance intelligence assets. And the other dimension, of course, is that, in effect, Obama is not waging a campaign against the terrorists, because these terrorists are, in fact, the foot soldiers of the Western Military Alliance in Syria, and they are, in fact, protecting the terrorists. This is amply confirmed, and it's come to our attention since the onset of the Russian bombing, and the Russians are going after the real terrorists. So that when an occurrence such as that of Paris or Bamako is presented then to the media, or that the media analyzes these events, what they do is simply copy and paste the official narrative without presenting an understanding of who is actually behind these terrorist organizations. Almost immediately, in the wake of the terrorist attacks in Paris, the French media went into overdrive, stating unequivocally, and that was prior to the conduct even of a police investigation, that the Islamic State was indelibly behind these attacks. And then the president, François Hollande, ordered by decree a national emergency, the suspension of civil liberties, the right to enter homes and arrest people without a warrant, and at the same time he closed down the borders. Now this, as I recall, was announced a few minutes before midnight on November 13th local time, prior to any consultation with his cabinet colleagues. He actually confirmed that the cabinet meeting was to take place subsequently, and in his speech he says, "We know who they are." And immediately the French media says, "This is a French-style 9/11. And they, in other words, in French, he says, "Le 11 septembre. Le 11 septembre à la française." And following from that, the official story prevails. But the official story is based with the fundamental, as I mentioned, the fundamental contradiction. You can't, on the one hand, say you're the victim of the Islamic State when, in fact, you're the creator of the Islamic State. It's the non sequitur. You cannot say that the attacks, and he was very explicit, the attacks from outside France, from Syria, originating from Syria. You can't say that the attacks originating from Syria directed against the French Republic and at the same time support covertly these same terrorists. And there's ample evidence that not only the United States and its allies have supported the ISIS and its affiliate groups, such as the Libya Islamic Fighting Group, so has France, with weapons, with training, with financing, and so on. So that is the situation. And what the French public and Western public in general have been led to believe is that these terrorists are involved in crimes against humanity without realizing that, in fact, their intelligence services, which are under the auspices of an elected government, are manipulating these terror organizations, are supporting them, are providing them with weapons.
You write that the Islamic State, ISIS, the alleged architect of the Paris attacks, was originally an al-Qaeda-affiliated entity created by U.S. intelligence with the support of Britain's MI6, Israel's Mossad, Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence, ISI, and Saudi Arabia's General Intelligence Presidency, GIP. You write that, quote, from the outset of Obama's bombing campaign in August-September 2014, the U.S.-led coalition has not bombed ISIS rebel positions, unquote. Has the U.S. counterterrorism campaign been fake?
Well, absolutely. This is a self-proclaimed counterterrorism campaign, but in effect, it is there to justify the bombing of a sovereign country in derogation of international law. The United States has been pressuring the government of Bashar al-Assad to step down. They want regime change. And they have not been able to achieve that despite 4 years of intensive terrorist activities, which they sponsor on the ground. And in the last year, we're talking about a bombing raid which has lasted for 13 months or more, and which is in effect supporting those terrorist entities. Now, we can say, well, where do you get the information as to who is behind these terrorists? And I can tell you that from day one, in March 2011, the terrorists were sent in with the support of the Western Military Alliance. And in fact, this was reported in August 2011 by DEPCA, which is an intelligence online media which I'm not saying that I trust DEPCA, but they acknowledge very clearly, and it's corroborated by other reports, that the initiative of the Western Military Alliance was actually launched by NATO, and it consisted in setting up a campaign to enlist thousands of Muslim volunteers in Muslim countries, which would then be coordinated by NATO in Brussels and the Turkish High Command. And that is exactly what has happened. And it took a long time for Western public opinion to actually even realize that the so-called opposition forces against the government of Bashar al-Assad were actually terrorists. And then when these atrocities were committed, they'll say invariably, and they probably still do, the Western media would blame Bashar al-Assad of killing his own people. Well, we have enough information to know that this so-called war on terrorism is fake. The United States and its allies are involved in a criminal undertaking in violation of international law against a sovereign country, its geopolitics, its economic conquest, and they're using the war on terrorism as a pretext. And now the bombing campaign is really in response to the fact that government forces in 2014 actually had managed to pacify a large part of Syrian territory, and the terrorists had been terrorist pockets had been eliminated. So they initiated the bombing campaign, and then they fast-tracked the recruitment and training of terrorists out of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and so on and so forth. All of this is known. And the thing is that the Western media will actually acknowledge the fact that Turkey is responsible for this, that, and other, that Saudi Arabia, we can't trust them, they're supporting the terrorists, Qatar is supporting the terrorists. But, of course, the Western countries are not supporting the terrorists, even though their allies are obeying orders. I mean, Qatar is not really a country. It's a proxy state in the Persian Gulf. It obeys orders. There's a whole series of military and intelligence bases there, close to Doha, the capital of Qatar. Saudi Arabia, the same. These are countries which are aligned with Washington. They receive military aid. They are told what to do. And historically, going back to the Soviet-Afghan war, we know that Pakistan's military intelligence, inter-services intelligence, ISI, and its Saudi counterparts were funding this operation. They were recruiting the terrorists. It's corroborated by Brzezinski and so on and so forth. All this is known, and the CIA does not deny it. What they say, of course, is that in the wake of the Cold War, they ceased their relationship with al-Qaeda, and then al-Qaeda turned against us, so to speak. This is absolute nonsense. Because I can tell you for one thing is that the actual terrorists continued to be trained in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And in fact, the proclaimed architect of the bombing of the hotel in Bamako, Belmokhtar, was recruited by the CIA in 1991. The Soviet-Afghan war was already over. The Cold War was over. And the CIA was continuing to recruit these people. Who were they recruiting? They were recruiting potential intelligence assets, which could then be deployed in a number of countries. The former Soviet Union, of course, the Russian Federation, Chechnya, but also in the Middle East. And it just so happens that Belmokhtar was trained in Pakistan and Afghanistan by the CIA, and then he was sent back in 93 to Algeria, and today he is behind a fraction of what is called al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, and the operation which was launched in Bamako allegedly was undertaken by his group on the one hand, and the broader organization, which is called Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, AQIM, which is an affiliate of Al-Qaeda. I should mention that AQIM is also very much integrated with the so-called Libya Islamic Fighting Group, which was supported by NATO during the campaign, the NATO campaign against Libya in 2011, so that NATO supports the Libya Islamic Fighting Group, which in effect has more or less merged with AQIM, the architect of the Bamako bombing, this mythical figure, Mokhtar Belmokhtar, is actually trained by the CIA. There's CIA all over the place, and they cannot deny, because the evidence is so compelling, that the intelligence services of Western countries are supporting the terrorists, and at the same time, the governments of Western countries are waging a campaign allegedly against the Islamic State, when in fact they're also supporting the Islamic State, and they're using this as a pretext to bomb a sovereign country, resulting in tens of thousands of casualties, a refugee crisis, the destruction of entire cities, and so on, during a period of 4 years. That is the picture. And we don't need to start engaging in any kind of conspiracy theories to underscore the fact that if the intelligence services of France and the United States are supporting ISIS, and ISIS is designated as the threat to the security of the French nation, there's an obvious contradiction, because you can't support the ISIS and then make a speech at 12 o'clock at night, I'm talking about President Hollande, and say, we know who they are, they're attacking us, okay? They're killing our people. So I think, to put it mildly, President François Hollande has blood on his hands.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, State Terrorism, Franco-American Style. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Now, you've been referring to the Bamako, Mali attacks, the most recent terror attacks. News media report that the Bamako terror operation was coordinated by Mokhtar Belmokhtar, whom you have mentioned. What do you think is the significance of the Bamako attacks? And were the Mali attacks in Bamako related to the Paris terror? For instance, what was France's role in the Libyan war and the takedown of Muammar Gaddafi? Is this all related?
Well, let me put it this way. Both attacks, both the Paris attacks as well as the Bamako attacks, have geopolitical implications. First, with regard to Paris, it's worth noting that 1 week before these attacks occurred, Paris, the Hollande government, had ordered the deployment of the Charles de Gaulle aircraft carrier group to the Mediterranean, to the Eastern Mediterranean, and this was in support of the alleged campaign against terrorism in Syria, so that they were actually, even before these attacks occurred, they'd already been preparing to send this powerful navy and air force deployment to the Middle East in support of Obama's campaign against the ISIS. And in the wake of the Paris attacks, as we recall, the French Air Force went in and bombed the alleged headquarters of ISIS. And the official declaration from the Ministry of Defense was that they had actually targeted the command posts. We got information from Syria that, in fact, what they targeted were health clinics, a museum, and the stadium. In other words, the country's civilian infrastructure. And that has been persistent throughout the last year since the United States started to bomb Syria. Now, with regard to Bamako, the geopolitical agenda is essentially to create a pretext and a justification for the intervention of France and the United States in sub-Saharan Africa. And they would be directing their actions, allegedly, of course, against terror organizations which threaten partner governments in Africa, which is nonsensical because they control those terror organizations, whether it's Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb or Boko Haram in Nigeria or the Libya Islamic Fighting Group. All these organizations are intelligence assets, and they're being used to destabilize sovereign countries. And now the Bamako attacks will no doubt also be used by France, by the United States, to extend, to, in a sense, to recolonize Africa in terms of militarization of the entire continent, the control over resources, etc., the destabilization of post-colonial societies, which they're doing. They're doing through various mechanisms. But I suspect that the geopolitics underlying the Bamako terror attack is militarization of Africa. And I should mention that U.S. AFRICOM also sent in a contingent into Mali to assist the French and Malian special forces, which stormed the hotel. And U.S. Africa Command is the key to this militarization of Africa. Now, I should mention that François Hollande is, in fact, a U.S. proxy. I mean, he acts on behalf of Washington. He has absolutely no concern in actually protecting the French spheres of influence in West Africa, for instance. And the alliance with the United States is it's a subordinate alliance. France is a subordinate to Washington, is in fact to pave the way towards the U.S. colonization of the African continent, which historically, as we recall, was really colonized by the Europeans. Okay, and they even in the late 19th century, they had a conference. It's called the Berlin Conference, where they carved up Africa into different sections and then divided the continent. But America was not included in that process. And now what we see emerging is, in fact, the displacement of the former colonial powers in Africa. Specifically, well, Portugal has already gone, and so has Spain, and so has Belgium, and France is ultimately being displaced by the United States. Francophone countries are becoming Americanized. The dollar will eventually replace the CFA franc, which is a proxy currency linked to the French. Well, it's linked to the French Treasury, but it's tied into the euro. And so I think that is the scenario. It's the conquest of the African continent, which is supported by the mandate, the self-proclaimed mandate of the Obama administration to go after the terrorists in sub-Saharan Africa, Boko Haram, Akim, and so on. And they're doing that in all the various areas where they want to extend their zone of influence. So you have, of course, in Southeast Asia, you'll have the Jamia Islami in Indonesia and Malaysia. And then you've got, of course, various other jihadist organizations in the western part of China, which are involved again in insurgencies, and they're also supported by Western intelligence via Pakistani's ISI.
It sounds like the United States and France are working very closely together, and that there is then evidence that French military escalation directed against Syria was planned before the November 13th terrorist attacks. What evidence is there, if any, of official foreknowledge of the Paris terror itself?
Well, you're absolutely right that France has been participating in the bombing raids right from the outset. And ironically, they operate out of the United Emirates, Arab Emirates, which in fact hosts the terrorist organizations or trains them and so on. Now, with regard to foreknowledge, I don't want to necessarily tackle it in those terms, but there were certain events which I considered revealing. The fact that about a month and a half before, there was an article in Paris Match, which is a bit, it's a tabloid magazine, which is widely read and very authoritative. And in this Paris Match report, it was stated that there would be, within a short period of time, there would be an attack. And they used the term 9/11 French style, Le 11 septembre à la Française. That was, in fact, the title of the article. And so the Paris Match on October 2nd predicted a French-style 9/11. And they said that the attacks in France will be on a scale comparable to 9/11. And they also said that intelligence services fear a 9/11 French style. And then you ask yourself, well, what was the purpose of this media report? Is it media disinformation? Is it there to create a hype or create an atmosphere of fear and intimidation prior to the actual events? But ironically, when the events occurred, the media was actually simply restating what had been said about a month and a half ago. They said this is a terrorist attack similar to 9/11. And they also pointed immediately, without any evidence, to the fact that these attacks came from Syria. And then, of course, as we recall, subsequently, a few days later, the French president, after having declared a national emergency, stated this is an act of war against us, despite the fact that this is not an act of war, it's simply an event, it's a terror event, it's not an act of war. But he said it's an act of war because we're being attacked by a foreign power, and that foreign power allegedly is in northern Syria somewhere, in Raqqa. It just so happens that we support these terrorists, but we have to invoke, in a sense, the fact that we're being attacked from outside, so that then we can also then claim with our coalition partners in NATO and the European Union the doctrine of collective security. That's Article 5 of NATO, which says an attack against one member of NATO is an attack against all members of NATO. And that's what they invoked on September the 12th, 2001, in the wake of 9/11, saying that it was an attack against the United States from abroad, although we didn't witness any Afghani planes in the skies of New York. But they're doing exactly the same. They're replicating the discourse, the 9/11 discourse, the fact that this is an attack from a foreign power. It just so happens that that foreign power is in northern Syria somewhere, and they're using this as a pretext to escalate the war against Syria, not against their proxy terrorists in Raqqa, and to justify a new wave of bombing by coalition forces. And I think that is ultimately the agenda.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, State Terrorism, Franco-American Style. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
But then they have to confront Russia, because Russia is also Russia is going after the real terrorists. Okay, and I think that one of the dimensions of this particular attack is that they need now, they need a mechanism or a pretext to undermine Russia's endeavors, which consist essentially in destroying the foot soldiers of the Western Military Alliance, which are the terrorists, these various entities which are supported covertly by the CIA, by MI6, by Mossad, and which are integrated by special forces in permanent liaison with the Western Military Alliance. These foot soldiers, they have their commanders, and those commanders are also in liaison with NATO or the United States. And the fact is that Israel is also behind the terrorists, and we don't even need to speculate on that. They've actually said that they have a facility in the Golan Heights. They're bringing in wounded terrorists from Syria into the Golan Heights with hospital facilities. They have Israeli advisors within the terrorist formations and so on. And we have photo ops, again, of Netanyahu with terrorist commanders being given hospital treatment in the Golan Heights. So the issue is that none of what we are discussing here will be given coverage in the mainstream media, and the public is drowned with a humanitarian discourse. Innocent people are being killed, and it's those events where terrorists attack innocent people which ultimately create within everybody this feeling of solidarity, of fear as well. But ultimately, when people die, we feel it, okay? And then what we do is that we side with the government, okay? That's what they're doing. Everybody is siding with the French government. Even people who hate François Hollande, they're siding with the French government because the French government is there to protect them, and they are shocked and concerned about the loss of life. And that concept or that procedure there is well entrenched, in fact, in U.S. military doctrine. I should remind listeners of what was called Operation Northwoods. It was during the Kennedy administration. It was a secret plan by the Joint Chiefs of Staff to start killing people in the Miami Cuban community, as well as in Washington, with a view to justifying a war of retribution against Cuba. And I quote from the official document. They said we kill people in Miami, and that creates, quote, a useful wave of indignation. Okay? Indignation of U.S. public opinion, which is a normal thing. Okay? Everybody has indignation when people are killed. And then they say, well, Cuba, Fidel Castro has attacked America. We have to attack Cuba in retribution. Now, that is the logic of these so-called false flags. And Operation Northwoods, the documents are there. People can go and consult them because those secret documents have been declassified after half a century. And we know that the U.S. military were contemplating this. It was turned down by Kennedy, and it was also turned down by the Defense Secretary McNamara at the time, okay? So that, in effect, it was a plot from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, no doubt also supported by U.S. intelligence at the time. And just to mention one further element, the concept is what General Tommy Franks, who was Central Command commander responsible for the invasion of Iraq, and he called this a terrorist massive casualty producing event, which results in civilian casualties. And he said that in effect, these terrorist massive casualty-producing events constitute an instrument which enables the government to militarize. In this case, he was talking about the United States, to militarize the United States. And in effect, that's exactly what's happening in France. Okay, the massive casualty-producing event in Paris is being used as a pretext to declare martial law, to suspend civil liberties. It is what I'd call the end of the French Republic. It marks the end of the French Republic and the potential transition to a totalitarian regime under the disguise of democracy or representative government.
I'm glad you mentioned Operation Northwoods, because we are actually recording this interview on November 22nd, which is the 52nd anniversary of the assassination of the President of the United States, John Kennedy. And, of course, we have seen endless war ever since. In terms of the media coverage of the Paris terror attacks, it seems like the notion of revenge is being used as a motivating factor. And, of course, this is a contradictory claim, right?
Well, you know, revenge, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, has been with us for several thousand years. You need a pretext to wage war, and war in the modern context, and the leaders, the political leaders know that. They know that war is the ultimate crime under Nuremberg. Whatever the underlying motive, the only war which is allowed is a war of self-defense, okay? You're allowed to defend yourself against aggression. But under Nuremberg, any act of war against a foreign country is a criminal undertaking. And what these attacks and deaths of civilians are there to perform is to give a mandate to the government to initiate a war of retribution against a foreign country, in this case Syria, even though Syria, they're not even saying officially that the Syrian government is behind the terrorists. They'll probably start saying that at one point, okay, when in fact we know that Bashar al-Assad has been combating terrorism from mid-March of 2011, okay? It's been a battle of government forces against terrorism, and those terrorists are supported by foreign powers, so that certainly Syria can invoke self-defense. But for France to invoke self-defense on the grounds that it's been attacked by some elusive entity in northern Syria is far-fetched. But it seems that people are buying it. They're saying, yes, we have to act and an act of revenge. Now, the other dimension is that throughout France, the police are on a rampage. We have official figures as to the number of house searches and arrests and so on, but none of those official figures actually should be taken seriously, because what's happening now is that the Muslim community of France, which represents approximately, it's something somewhat less of 10% of the population, these people are being subjected to a witch hunt. So that we're in a situation which might be called the Spanish Inquisition. That I should mention historically, the French Inquisition of the Middle Age was far worse. But so it's an inquisitorial type of situation where you're going after people. The wave of the anti-terrorism is coupled with Islamophobia. And ultimately, it's quite logical from a geopolitical or economic standpoint to demonize Muslims, because it just so happens that the Muslims are the inhabitants of countries which possess the world's oil reserves, okay? I mean, I've made the calculus is that up to 65 to 70% of the reserves of crude oil, I'm not talking about natural gas or other forms of oil like tar sands, but between 65 and 70% of crude oil reserves are in Muslim countries. a large part of which is, of course, in that region extending from the tip of Saudi Arabia up to the Caspian Sea basin. Now, so if those countries which have those oil reserves happen to be Buddhists, the whole campaign would be directed against Buddhists. They need to demonize the Muslims as a pretext to wage their battle for oil.
And, of course, what begins as a demonization of Muslims or whatever group ultimately laps over into everybody else, right? The population at large. You've mentioned the state of emergency that has been declared in France. Drastic police state measures, I would assume, are part of such a state of emergency, arbitrary arrest. And you mentioned that we're witnessing an end to the French Republic.
Absolutely. But the thing is that what is implied there is that to enforce an imperial agenda, you scrap the Republic. Now, Julius Caesar understood that perfectly well. I can't remember the exact quote, but he said, you don't build an empire with a republic. And I think that, in effect, what's happening is that the republic is being scrapped. It's not only being scrapped in France, it's being scrapped in America. Now, I just recall that, that Donald Trump, in his election campaign, is calling for police state measures directed against every single Muslim in the United States of America, okay? And establishing some kind of database to track Muslims in the U.S., okay? Now, he was rebuffed by his Republican cohorts, but nonetheless, that type of political narrative, which is based on promoting hate, is becoming very popular. And the promotion of hate is derived from these mass casualty-producing events, by the propaganda, of the demonization of Muslims, and so on. People are being used to share this divisiveness, okay? When in fact, people around the world, everybody is equal. Ultimately, we're all human beings, and we should be in solidarity with one another. And if it weren't for our leaders, which have geopolitical and economic intents of building and extending the empire, most probably we would all be rejoicing together in a multicultural environment. But that's not happening. And it's particularly serious in countries like, I'd say, Britain and France. Britain also is very much becoming very sectarian, and in the United States as well, up to a point.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, State Terrorism, Franco-American Style. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You've written that the global war on terrorism is a lie that provides legitimacy to police state measures. What do you think is behind the drive toward creating police states in what we might refer to as former republics?
Well, the police state is there to serve economic and geopolitical interests, strategic interests. It's there to support major corporate interests, the oil companies, the military-industrial complex, the defense contractors, Wall Street. And in effect, it's still a profit-driven. I mean, war is an economic endeavor. Okay, war is good for business, so to speak. And it's also it provides business to the people who produce the weapons, but it also extends the markets worldwide. And then, of course, initiatives, these so-called trade agreements, TPP and others, are tied into the military agenda. They're not isolated phenomena, and there's an interface. It's not by accident that Paul Wolfowitz, for instance, went from the U.S. Defense Department to the World Bank and back and forth and so on. There's an interface in Washington between the military and civilian entities, between the Treasury and the Pentagon, and then, of course, all these organizations such as the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, are part and parcel of that broader agenda. And what it really means, ultimately, is that politicians are no longer politicians. They are the instruments of lobby groups. I think we understand that. In an American context, we understand that. They're lobby groups which own the politicians, okay? And then ultimately, those politicians are incited by their corporate sponsors to commit criminal acts. Because Obama, in waging a campaign against Syria, is involved in a criminal act. It's against the law to go and bomb a sovereign country on whatever pretext. And it brings forth the notion of the criminalization of the state. Namely, the fact that the state is no longer there representing citizens, but it's representing corporations. Those corporations, in turn, are also involved in criminal undertakings. The financial system is fraudulent. It's criminalized. They get away with it. I mean, to maintain appearances, there's an occasional lawsuit against Goldman Sachs or JP Morgan Chase, but there's no actual confiscation of financial assets, as occurred, let's say, in Iceland, where in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, they actually confiscated the banks, and now they are actually redistributing the wealth to citizens. I mean, this is a rather unique occurrence. It's not to say that this means a change, a complete change in structure, but you don't see governments protecting the rights of citizens against powerful corporations. Corporations are running the world. The trade agreements override the Constitution. We know that. And there's an imperial agenda, which is ultimately an economic agenda. And the irony is that the United States is now set up a whole series of alliances with countries which were the victims of U.S. war crimes. I'm thinking of Vietnam, Cambodia, the Philippines, Indonesia. They're all allies of the United States. And that alliance is now directed against the People's Republic of China, which constitutes an encroachment to global hegemony. Not to say that China is necessarily an alternative. I don't think it is. But from a geopolitical standpoint, there are certain countries which the United States wants to get rid of, and that is, of course, the Russian Federation, the People's Republic of China, Iran, and, of course, North Korea. Those are the four countries that are encroachments. There may be others, but they're of lesser importance. And it's not by accident that all these four countries are being threatened simultaneously. In fact, the U.S. has negotiated an agreement with South Korea, which threatens North Korea. And I should mention, North Korea lost 30% of its population during the Korean War. And this is something which is well understood, because General Curtis LeMay actually said in a speech, we must have killed something of the order of 20% and destroyed something like 90% of the country's cities during the bombing raids which they implemented. And these atrocities have been committed in various parts of the world, Indonesia, you know, 500,000 to a million so-called communist sympathizers were killed on orders of the CIA. It's documented, because we actually have the declassified documents of the CIA on that event, and so on and so forth. So I would call this the criminalization of the state. And the criminalization of the state is totalitarian. because it goes against the rights of the citizens. It has an interest in retaining a democratic facade, a two-party system, the institutions of representative democracy. But we know that whoever comes into the White House, whether it's Hillary or Donald Trump, you know, or Jeb Bush, they will ultimately be figureheads, public relations figureheads, which will support dominant economic interests in the United States.
You write that, quote, the evidence amply confirms that while Russia is targeting ISIS strongholds in Syria, the Western military alliance is supporting the Islamic State terrorists, unquote. The Russian Federation is bombing ISIS while the Western military alliance is supporting the terrorists, but publicly everyone claims to be fighting ISIS. Is there an undeclared war going on between the Russian Federation and the Western military alliance?
Well, ultimately, yes, there is an undeclared war, and it could evolve in different directions, because the Russians are, in fact, targeting the foot soldiers of the Western military alliance. And, I mean, they're destroying the endeavors of the United States and its intelligence services, its military. Within the ranks of those terrorists are Western military advisors. We know that. But at the same time, the U.S. and its European partners have to play the game, so to speak. And they can't simply say to the Russians, well, you know, you're not actually, because it's so obvious, even to the broader public, that Obama's campaign has, so to speak, failed, whereas the Russian campaign, with limited air facilities, has actually, in a matter of a few weeks, has managed to undermine this terrorist presence inside Syria. You know, the apologists will say, or some people even on the left, they'll say, well, Obama's made a mistake. You know, he's screwed up. He doesn't know how to coordinate these attacks, et cetera, as if, okay? They have these terrorists in Toyota pickup trucks. If they had wanted to eliminate them, they could have done it very easily right at the beginning when they crossed the desert from Syria into Iraq. But the purpose was not to destroy them. The purpose was actually to protect them, so that the U.S. has been very effective in protecting them and also in dispelling an understanding by public opinion that they actually were involved in supporting the terrorists rather than going after them. And now, of course, the ball game is different because the Russians are there. And ironically, they have established channels of cooperation, let's say, between France and Russia with regard to counterterrorism. But Putin is a very astute diplomat, as well as he's, of course, an intelligence, a former KGB official, and he knows how to play that kind of game. He hasn't accused, the Russian media isn't accusing François Hollande of being complicit in these attacks. Quite the opposite. They're saying, buddy, buddy, Putin comes up to François Hollande and says, let's cooperate, let's collaborate. And then Hollande is going to go to Moscow. And that, of course, in a sense, may create some divisiveness within the Western military alliance. It may also uphold the legitimacy of François Hollande, because he's not being bashed by the Russians. And there's a very careful game which is ongoing. But if you look at the broader picture, namely the fact that NATO, U.S. NATO, is at Russia's doorstep in Eastern Europe, in the Baltic states, for instance, both with conventional weapons as well as the air defense, the defense shield, and they say that the defense shield is directed not against Russia but against Iran, which is nonsensical. It's directed against every single major Russian city, okay? So they're targeting them there. Then they are, of course, they're supporting an illegal government in Ukraine, which is integrated by neo-Nazis. That is ongoing. And they are intent on destabilizing the Russian economy through sanctions, through financial mechanisms. That's also ongoing. But in turn, what has happened, what has emerged, is that Russia has, Russians' actions in the military sphere have shown the Americans that we can do what you can do. We have advanced capabilities, which everybody knows they have. And it is ultimately, it appears to be the source of tremendous diplomatic embarrassment that the Russians have been able to liquidate the terrorists in a matter of months. And the United States has been so inept, but in fact they haven't been inept because they never intended to actually go after the terrorists.
Michel Chosadovsky, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show has been State Terrorism, Franco-American Style. Michel Chosadovsky is the founder, director, and editor of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. The Global Research website, globalresearch.ca, publishes news articles, commentary, background research, and analysis. Michel Chosadovsky is the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, America's War on Terrorism, The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity, as well as co-editor of the anthology, The Global Economic Crisis, The Great Depression of the 21st Century. All books are available at globalresearch.ca. That's globalresearch.ca. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yaro Mako, and Tony Rango. To leave comments or order copies of shows, email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. That's faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Visit our website at gunsandbutter.org to sign up for our email list and receive our newsletter. Follow us at G&B Radio.
Hey!
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Your online antidote to corporate media crap. You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Michael Parenti is back, speaking ad lib on capitalism, socialism, the electric company, money, plutocrats in general, the Waltons in particular, and other pains in the neck. I hope you'll stay tuned. It seems that so many of our important progressive intellectuals are now quite old or, worse, recently deceased. In recent years, we lost that patrician, good guy, novelist and essayist Gore Vidal, and we lost the progressive historian Howard Zinn. We lost some good lesser lights, too. Journalist Molly Ivins and folk singer-storyteller Utah Phillips, for example. Still with us, fortunately, are two certifiable really old guys, Noam Chomsky and Michael Parenti. Intellectuals, scholars, professors, activists, and great public speakers with a big public following, both of them. Noam Chomsky's birthday is right around the corner, December 7. He was born in 1928 on Pearl Harbor Day, 13 years before it was Pearl Harbor Day. If you wanted to send him a card saying, "Happy birthday and thanks," probably you could address it to the Department of Linguistics, MIT, Cambridge, Mass. His old office. I'm sure they've got his forwarding address. Yes, Department of Linguistics. Chomsky was a great figure in the field of academic linguistics before he became a great analyst and critic of contemporary politics and world affairs. Happy birthday, Noam. Neither I nor Wikipedia knows political scientist Michael Parenti's exact birthday, but it was in 1933, and he is 82 as I speak. And it is to Parenti that we now turn. On October 6, 2015, he was in fine form in the question-and-answer session following a good speech he gave in Springfield, Illinois. The speech was titled Capitalism Versus Reality, and we shall hear it, I expect, sometime soon. Today, though, more of the Q&A, and then afterwards, a very brief Parenti recording or two from a decade or so ago. In the Q&A, the discussion continues of the merits and problems of capitalism, and the merits and problems of socialism. Spoiler alert, socialism comes out ahead, in Parenti's view. Here's the first topic today. Springfield, Illinois, apparently is served by a publicly owned electric power company. The ratepayers are not entirely pleased with the service and the prices of this public utility. Having a publicly owned power company is a form of socialism, isn't it? Well, one audience member thinks the local power company makes a pretty poor advertisement for socialism. Could a capitalist for-profit electric company be much worse than what they've got? Parenti replies, "You betcha. Try living with Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E, as he does back in Berkeley." This is a fun dialogue. And underneath it is a very interesting exploration of capitalism and its alternatives. Here's Michael Parenti.
you have a socialist enterprise as CWLP, a socialist program like Social Security, but exists within a capitalist system. And are these movements towards change? Do they support the capitalist system?
Sure, they do. What? You mean the public utility supports capitalism? Well, I guess it might. It has to function in a capitalist system. But no, it's not supporting capitalism. Capitalism is when these lights go on and somebody is making money off the fact that these lights are on. Somebody who doesn't work with these lights, who doesn't work with anything we do, but something comes out of your pocket. If you're paying for this, if you're paying with your tuition some of the expenses of this university, you're paying for these lights and the Koch brothers, maybe they're the guys involved in it, or David, the Koch brothers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe David Rockefeller, somebody. Every time in New York, every time I put the light on, I was helping Nelson Rockefeller and David Rockefeller, making him richer. Why? What do these people have that they can get billions and billions of dollars? Walmart's, why must we... What did Walmart's ever invent? What did the Walton family? The Walton family of the top 10 richest people in America, four of them are from the Walton family. Of the top 25, I think it's about six or seven altogether. Add up all their wealth, it's over $150 billion. Now, what did they do to get this kind of money? Whose money is that? It's our money. We got to pay it up. And they so underpay their workers that their workers have to go out and get food stamps. They're so underpaid that around Christmas time, they ask the public to come in and toss in cans of food and all for their own workers. They're shameless, these Walton family. They're shameless about it. And they get richer and richer. They got more money than they could spend in five lifetimes in the most freest way, wildest way. What is that about? This is a rational system. This is the way our people, we got people struggling and fighting, paying the Waltons for doing nothing and just riding on our backs. So that's why I think it's the public utilities. And the public utility can provide lights that are just as good as any other lights. They're not blinking out or flashing, are they?
Some of them are probably flashing.
But look, the public utility will pay a public salary to the president of it. That means he'll get, what, $100,000, $200,000. If it's a private utility, he'll get a private salary, and that'll be $5, $6, $10, $15 million. So that's one thing I don't like. What's so great about this guy? We got to give him $15 million salary? Why do they spend so much on public propaganda all the time, telling us what a great job they do, how selfless they are, how thoughtful they are? That's all I hear from PG&E, that they do nothing but love us and take care of us and all that. So meanwhile, he's got his hand in my pocket, on my wallet. So why wouldn't I oppose that? If some guy held you up on the street and grabbed your money, you'd be angry and furious as hell. You might even put your life at risk to want to pop him one and grab it back or something. But that's what these guys are doing. They're doing it in a system of shaking us down and stealing it from us. It's a form of theft. That's what capitalism is. It's a siphoning up to the top. Those who do less, profits are what you make when you're not working. If you're working, then, you know, people say to me, oh, yeah, you're against capitalism, but you get royalties on your books, don't you? Your book, I got you there. Huh? I said, look, Jerko, I wrote that book. I sweat and I wrote that book. I created that book. I worked for days and days and days, over a year writing that book. And the copy editor who went over it, he spent about 4 days copy editing that book. You know, he should get some kind of pay for it. And the editor too. And the salesman who goes out and sells it to the bookstore or to Amazon or whatever, they should get a cut. So don't tell me, I'm not freeloading. We work for it. The freeloader is the guy who owns the publishing company, Macmillan. Macmillan was, it was Harold Macmillan, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He owns St. Martin's Press.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting there in my living room, And he comes on the air, Harold Macmillan. You don't remember him. He was Prime Minister of England, an old guy years ago. And he said, and Dick Cavett was interviewing him and said, so what do you do now that you're no longer Prime Minister? You're sort of retired. And he says, well, the family has a little publishing house that does quite well. And he did that, he made that little sound, you know, and I want to sit in there. And I was going, geez. And I wanted to really put my foot through my own television set. You know, that's how crazy you can get sometimes. And I said, he's the only guy who isn't, who isn't contributing anything. He's just skimming the top off. He can sit back and run for Prime Minister of England. The Macmillan family was getting rich on St. Martin's Press, which is still a pretty big press mm-hmm. right now. They don't publish my books anymore.
Mm-hmm. Do I just try to repeat? There's growing inequality. There's growing oppositions and class conflict of various kinds. What does Dr. Parenti see as where that might go? Is there might be some violence or revolutionary possibilities on the horizon? Is that right? You're interested in finding out where he thinks this might end up?
When it gets so utterly desperate with the French Revolution, you had the pitchforks come out. You know, Barack Obama himself made a comment to one of these big business groups where he said, you know, I'm the only thing between you and the pitchforks. I thought that was a fascinating statement. He was talking about 1798, the French Revolution, mm-hmm. 1797, I forget. Yeah, but the French Revolution, you had two things, utter misery. People were utter misery. And two, their opponent wasn't that powerful anymore. Louis the 16th, who went to the guillotine. Mm-hmm. He didn't have, I mean, his own guards were wavering and turning against him. And you had another class coming along. It was that middle class, that bourgeoisie class, and you had leaders like Robespierre and these people. They were playing for keeps. What frightens me is I think we may end up worse than that with a populace that doesn't fight back, they're too thoroughly brainwashed. They've decided that this is all happening because people are being hostile toward Christianity or because women insist on getting abortions or something. You know, the development of false consciousness is much, much more clever than Marie Antoinette sitting there and saying, mm-hmm. you have no food, let them eat cake, you know. And she was preparing her own guillotine. So that's the problem. I don't see it. And then sometimes you don't know. Then you get surprised. You get utterly surprised. Look at those students who did go there. And you're right. They didn't say occupy the Pentagon. I made this point. Well, I wrote somewhere. They didn't say occupy Pentagon, occupy White House, occupy Congress. No, they went to the heart of the creature. Occupy Wall Street. They were saying who, and they put that right on the table. Then you got, you know. We didn't go anywhere with it. We didn't get enough organization out of it. And they got crushed. They all got crushed. But the one big gain they made was the propaganda gain of talking about 1% and 99%. Well, there are those of us who have been for years trying to talk about the great divide between the rich and such. When in a country where people think, oh, we're all middle class, there's a few poor down there, a few losers, you know, and there's a few super rich, but they're nothing. But we're in America, we're all middle class. Baloney. Baloney all middle class. And the middle class is fighting and struggling and is holding on like this, you know, if it's holding on at all. So I really don't know what the future has in store. And then there's the additional pressure. We may be running out of time. The French in 1790 never had this problem, but we are facing an ecology that is in a crisis of a kind that we've never seen. Well, these idiots, they're actually celebrating this, some of them. There are actually now corporations arising that are designed to help people take advantage of climate change, mm-hmm. how they can make money on climate mm-hmm. change. They're crazy, you know. Years ago, I said, these people are not going to come to their senses until the North Pole melts. That was my term, the North Pole, meaning the Arctic. Well, the Arctic is melting. It's now melting in my lifetime. I can't believe it. And what are they doing? They're getting up there saying, oh, isn't this good? We can have a Northwest Passage now. So Lewis and Clark wanted a Northwest Passage, right? In fact, Columbus himself wanted it, was looking for a passage to get around there. And we can do this, and we'll be able to do that, and we can cut off. We don't have to go around Cape Horn anymore and all that. So that's crazy. They really are. And it's causing all sorts of ecological things. The Gulf Stream, the Caribbean Stream and all that, it's going to change tremendous. It's going to make tremendous changes of climates in the North American continent and even in Europe. It may be a disaster of momentous dimensions, and it may come in your lifetime. I don't know.
A questioner suggests that no real change in the American system can take place so long as we are caught up in the monetary system. Parenti disagrees, though. The main problem isn't with money itself, he thinks. The main problem is that not enough money goes to the people who earned it by their work, and too much money goes to the fat cats who just sit back and pocket the profits of other people's work. We return to Michael Parenti.
If you didn't have a monetary system, what would you use? I mean, in a complex society like this, we can't have a trading system or. Well, people don't lose their intelligence. They don't lose their sense of self-interest and other interests. In fact, it gets better under socialism. Look at Mondragon, which is an anarchist. It's not socialist. It's mm-hmm. an anarchist organization in Spain. Mm-hmm. And they started with small, you know, making clocks. Just workers employing workers and nobody else. Workers working for themselves. And that's built up into a large society. Well, they gave a better salary to the top guys who had to stay there late at night and take on more responsibility than to work. So they developed changes and such, but they weren't stealing from me. When I bought something made by the Mondragon cooperative workers, anarchist workers, every penny in that went to some guy or gal who earned it, who had been working in it. And so what the monetary system is not, it's a convenience, it's a way of doing it. Now, it's not true. Of course, money was invented with wealth. That is true. At a certain point, kings could not give 700 fur skins to somebody in a trade or swap some camels or animals or whatever else, or gold plates or different gold cups and all that. So they invented coins, and that became a way of accumulating wealth. It's an instrument of wealth accumulation. That's what's so wrong with a monetary system. But if you don't have kings and you don't have CEOs who are plundering your company and all that, I don't see where the money would be such a danger.
And thank you very much to all of you and to Dr. Michael Parenti. Thank you.
I've got 90,000 pounds in my pajamas. I've got 40,000 French francs in my fridge. I've got lots of lovely lira. Now the Deutsche Mark's getting dearer, and my dollar bills would buy the Brooklyn Bridge. There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is nothing quite as beautiful as cash. Some people say it's folly, but I'd rather have the lolly. With money you can make a splash. There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is nothing like a newly minted pound. Everyone must hanker for the butchness of a banker. It's accountancy that wakes the world around. You can keep your Marxist ways, but it's only just a phase. For it's money, money, money makes the world go.
Sorry about that. I couldn't resist. That was Monty Python's Flying Circus from way, way back. from back in the days when they were national currencies, with names like pound and Deutschmark and lira and franc. Of course, the pound is still with us. The United Kingdom joined the EU, but never joined the European Monetary Union. So the UK still has some control over its own currency. Don't you wish, Athens? We'll turn now to a short studio recording Michael Parenti made in 2005. This 5-minute essay is called Welfare for the Wealthy. It's about how the federal government gives billions of your tax dollars each year to the big corporations, while doing very little for small business and still less for the citizens. Again, this was recorded in 2005, 3 years before Wall Street's fraud and irresponsible risk-taking crashed the national economy. Immediately after the crash, your government gave trillions of your dollars to the giant banks and financial firms, making sure that their investors did not lose a penny in the economic crash that they caused. The people, meanwhile, got unemployment, home foreclosures, and almost zero assistance from the government. Parenti was proved right with a vengeance. Small comfort there. From 2005, here is Michael Parenti on Welfare for the Wealthy.
Welfare for the Wealthy. Big business is fond of preaching the virtues of self-reliance and individual initiative. Big businessmen are fond of denouncing those who run to the government for handouts. But in fact, no interest feeds more lavishly out of the public trough than corporate America. Successive administrations have dedicated themselves to supporting the corporate system. They offer an array of subsidies and services to business. They impose a taxation system that shifts costs and diseconomies onto the general public. And they launch military spending programs that have transformed the United States into a permanent war economy. Rather than a laissez-faire government that does little, we have a corporate state that plays an increasingly active role in sustaining the process of capital accumulation for big corporations. The federal government leases or sells at a mere fraction of market value billions of dollars worth of oil, coal, and mineral reserves and grazing and timber lands. In any given year, the government hands out billions to big business in tax exclusions, tax credits, price supports, loan guarantees, payments in kind, export subsidies, subsidized insurance rates, marketing services, irrigation and reclamation programs, and research and development grants. Billions from the U.S. taxpayer right into the pockets of the big rich corporations. The U.S. government permits public funds to remain on deposit in banks without collecting interest. It tolerates overcharging by firms with whom it does business, and it provides long-term credits, tariff protections, reduced tax assessments to large companies. Over $26 billion a year in federal crop subsidies benefit mostly big agribusiness and affluent farmers, with relatively little going to small producers. The federal government is losing up to $52 million a year by charging ranchers below-cost grazing rates on public lands. $97 billion in public subsidies has gone to the nuclear industry. Billions go for research and development straight into the corporate hands without the government collecting a penny in royalties. Mining companies extract valuable minerals and metals from public lands without paying royalties. One company mined a gold deposit in Nevada with an estimated value of over $7 billion without paying a royalty fee, and with the right, under the law, to purchase the land for $5 an acre. The U.S. Forest Service continues to open up national forests to timber companies at below the cost of running the program, for an average yearly government loss of many millions of dollars. The government directly subsidizes the railroad, airline, and shipping industries. It subsidizes exporters of iron, steel, textiles, tobacco, paper, and other products. Energy companies have received huge amounts in grants and tax incentives to encourage oil exploration. Billions of dollars go to bail out such giant companies as Chrysler and Lockheed, while small businesses are left to sink or swim. When one of the nation's largest banks, Continental Illinois, was on the brink of failure, it received $7.5 billion in federal aid. Another $8 billion went to the International Monetary Fund to offset the losses incurred by U.S. banks in bad loans to third world nations. No mom or pop business is bailed out when they go bankrupt or make a bad investment. These massive handouts supposedly are needed to create jobs, but big corporations create relatively few new jobs, no net gain in jobs after you count all their layoffs and downsizing. Almost all the new jobs in this economy are created from small and medium-sized business and from the growth in federal, state, and local governments. What these massive handouts do create is giant profits for the very few at the top. This is Michael Parenti for Radio Truth.
This commentary was produced by the LA Sound Posse and may be freely copied and distributed. You can find us on the web at lasoundposse.org. The music was Flute Medicine by Synth.
And that pretty much wraps it up for this week's New World Notes. The long Parenti recording was courtesy of the University of Illinois at Springfield, and also Dale Lehman of station WZRD in Chicago. I have edited and condensed the talk. Welfare for the Wealthy was courtesy of the L.A. Sound Posse. And our show comes to you courtesy of the spacious underground studios of WWUHFM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. On the web, find us at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Our show is produced by what is likely the smallest anarcho-syndicalist collective in all of Hartford County, the collective comprising me, myself, and yours truly, Kenneth Doust, chief cook and bottle washer and corresponding secretary. On behalf of all of us, let me say thank you for listening. Illegitimi non carborundum. Workers, arise. What have you got to lose? Try to speak the truth, and please come back again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 Wake Up.
I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The show you're about to hear today originally aired in the fall of 2014. Joining me today on the show to talk more about 9/11 and its aftermath is Stephen Lendman. Stephen Lendman is a writer, syndicated columnist, activist, news TV personality, and radio show host. He currently writes for MoneyNewsNow.com and VeteransToday.com and hosts, since 2007, a progressive radio show at the Progressive Radio NewsHour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stephen Lendman was born in 1934 in Boston, Mass., raised in a modest middle-income family, attended public schools, received a Harvard BA in 1956, and a Wharton MBA in 1960. After 6 years as a marketing research analyst, Lendman became part of a new small family business in 1967, remaining there until retiring in 1999. Since then, he has devoted his time to progressive causes, extensive reading, and since summer 2005, writing on vital world and national topics, including war and peace, American imperialism, corporate dominance, political persecutions, and a range of other social, economic, and political issues. He's also author of the celebrated books Banker Occupation, Waging Financial War on Humanity, and How Wall Street Fleeces America, Privatized Banking, Government Collusion, and Class War, and just recently, a new book called Flashpoint in Ukraine, which is a compilation of 22 geopolitical analysts countering the fraudulent Western narrative on Ukraine and why it matters so much. Stephen Lendman, welcome to the show.
Cheryl, it's good to be on with you.
Yes, now, you recently wrote an article called 9/11, The Mother of All Big Lies, and you began the article by stating that lies are an American tradition. Could you explain what that means and give us some examples?
Well, indeed, lies are an American tradition. America does not have exclusivity over what I like to call big lies with a capital B and a capital L. And I refer to them as big lies because we're talking about, in most cases, either major geopolitical issues or major domestic ones that affect the great majority of people in America. So if America decides to pass an act like the Patriot Act, that affects everybody. Well, of course, it does not affect the elites of America. It doesn't affect the corporate CEOs or the military commanders or the top officials in government, but it affects everybody else. You could call them the 99%. So these lies have incredible effects on people in America, on domestic issues, or around the world on the major geopolitical issues. As far as America goes, I mean, the big lies literally date from the Republic's inception. Big notable ones I mentioned in my article began in the mid-19th century when America annexed half of Mexico. America became Cuba's colonial power, and many other small independent nations came under America's control after that. The Philippines, Guam, Hawaii, Haiti, Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, goes on and on and on. Woodrow Wilson pawned the U.S. public into having America into World War I. He campaigned promising to keep America out of the war. My dad was in World War I in France. Thankfully, he came home. But he campaigned as a peace president, just like Obama. He promised no war. And immediately after being reelected in 1916, he formed the Creel Commission that literally turned Americans, pacifist Americans, into raging German haters. It goes on and on and on. Even World War II was very tainted. American intelligence tracked the Japanese fleet across the Pacific. But the commander, Commander Kimball in Hawaii, in Pearl Harbor, was not warned because Roosevelt wanted the war. The only way he could turn a pacifist Republic and a passed this Congress around was to create a mass casualty event. Well, he certainly got it. 9/11 was a mass casualty event. The Gulf of Tonkin was a famous big lie. Again, it goes on and on. The major things that happen in America or that America does around the world or domestically literally are based on big lies.
And why do you say 9/11 is the mother of all big lies?
Because of everything that happened after it. Look what happened after it. We literally waged war on humanity. George Bush, followed by Barack Obama. Afghanistan. There was a debate following 9/11. Did America attack Afghanistan or Iraq first? Afghanistan was chosen just weeks after the 9/11 event. And a very important thing to point out is this. Wars are not waged on the spur of the moment. It takes long planning before a war can be initiated. The Afghan war was planned months before 9/11. It was only a matter of when the trigger would be pulled and the attack would be launched. Well, 9/11, September 11, 2001, about 4 weeks later, the Patriot Act was passed, and 5 weeks later, after 9/11, America attacked Afghanistan. Why Afghanistan? Because it's a strategic asset, strategically important country. It's a country that has strategic importance in relation with Russia. It's sort of like a land-based aircraft carrier where America can base its troops, and America plans permanent occupation of Afghanistan. Most of the troops may be withdrawn, but Obama wants 10 or 20,000 remaining, and they will remain, and they will remain as a hostile force, mainly targeting Russia. Afghanistan is also rich in natural resources, which most people don't realize. It doesn't have a lot of oil. It has a lot of strategic resources. Estimates range that they could be worth as much as $1 trillion. Well, America wants its corporations to get their dirty hands on them. So these are some of the reasons that Afghanistan was chosen.
Of course, then they have the drug.
Oh, indeed. Afghanistan is the world's leading producer of opium, which is the product that goes into heroin. So the CIA makes billions of dollars trafficking heroin. Another story most people don't know. The Wall Street banks make billions and billions of dollars from drug money. I remember somebody telling a story, a person who used to work on Wall Street, who said, every Friday afternoon, the limousines drive up to the big New York banks, Citibank, J.P. Morgan Chase, or Morgan Stanley Brokerage House, Goldman Sachs, Wells Fargo, with suitcases. People get out of the limousines with suitcases. What have they got in the suitcases? Money, drug money, to be deposited every single Friday. This is big business. Mm-hmm. Afghanistan is extremely important. These are the reasons Afghanistan was chosen.
And when it comes to 9/11 or any other of the lies, does it matter which political party is in office, since both parties seem to go along with the cover-up of any of these lies?
It seems to me the Democrats are more warrior-like than Republicans. My God, you could go back in U.S. history, Lincoln the Civil War, Roosevelt World War II, Wilson World War I, Lyndon Johnson, Vietnam. It goes on and on and on. Of course, the Republicans are no slouches by any means. My goodness. I mean, they wage one war after another, and they certainly do it now. And George Bush was the president on September 11th, 2001, and immediately war began. He launched war with others planned. Iraq was the second one in mind. It came in March 2003, the second Iraq war. The first one began in January 2001. Bush Sr. launched that war. So the Republicans are no slouches when it comes to waging war. But you could basically say there's no difference between the parties. And I've said it and I've written many times. On the major issues, there's not a dime's difference between them. And the major issues are simple: war and peace, corporate empowerment, a police state apparatus ruling America, example, the Patriot Act and many others, Homeland Security Act. So basically, both parties are in lockstep. They differ on other issues. They're not unimportant, but they don't rise to the level of the biggest ones.
And can you tell me some aspects of 9/11 that made you question or doubt it? Why do you say it's a lie?
Well, I put in my article, Cheryl, the expert on 9/11, David Ray Griffin. David is an extraordinary man. He's written 10 books on 9/11. He is the expert on the topic. And I quoted from one of his articles. Let me just read what he said. He listed 21 reasons why the official story is a lie. There are a lot more than 21 reasons. But let me just read you the ones that he listed. The FBI admitted it had no hard evidence connecting 9/11 to bin Laden. And by the way, Obama did not kill Osama Bin Laden died in December 2001 of natural causes. He was a very ill man, kidney problems, other problems, and even Fox News at the time reported it. The BBC reported it. The New York Times reported it belatedly, and I remember quoting them. Around July of 2002, they reported that Bin Laden died at the end of 2001. So the story was reported, and then it was buried and forgotten. And Obama claiming he killed Osama was another big lie. I don't know who he killed, but it certainly wasn't Bin Laden. Second point by Griffin. So-called devout Muslim alleged hijackers drank heavily, frequented strip clubs, and paid for sex. Third point. Technology in 2001 made cell phone calls made from above 30,000 feet impossible. Claims were made that the wife of Ted Olson, I remember, called Ted Olson on her cell phone. Well, she did not, because cell phone at the altitude she was flying at could not get through to her husband, so that was another lie.
And that was verified by the FBI in the Mousawi trial, correct?
I believe so.
That didn't last more than 0 seconds.
Indeed. Another point. The FBI lied claiming Mohammed Atta left behind luggage containing decisive evidence about al-Qaeda being responsible for the 9/11 attacks. False. There was no evidence left behind indicating that, because al-Qaeda and bin Laden and so-called crazed Arabs had nothing to do with the 9/11 attack. Another point. Passports allegedly found at United 93's crash site were false. Another point. Alleged hijackers were not aboard the four fateful flights. By the way, I want to mention that the black boxes were finally found, and for years they were buried and not allowed to be made public. But there is a code that pilots or co-pilots in the cockpit can activate to alert a problem such as a hijacking. It's called 7500. None of the four pilots, none of the four co-pilots activated the 7500 code, meaning there was no problem. There was no reason for them to activate it. So that's another big lie. Another point. Standard operating intercept procedures were not followed. They're very clear, including launching aircraft to go after a suspected. If an aircraft has been hijacked, you would launch aircraft after it, not necessarily to shoot it down, but to stay right with it, to monitor it, and to follow and see exactly what's going on. There were no intercept procedures followed. Another point. Then Treasury Secretary Norman Mineta and Dick Cheney apparently confirmed a stand-down order prior to an alleged plane striking the Pentagon. Well, a plane did not strike the Pentagon. A missile struck the Pentagon. There were no bodies. There was no fuselage. There were no engines. There was no plane wreckage. A missile struck the Pentagon. And I remember in an earlier article I wrote years ago, an experienced commercial airline pilot saying it was virtually impossible for an airliner to get through all the obstructions that would have to be navigated to be able to strike the Pentagon. And even if it was possible to do that, the Pentagon has such defenses, they would shoot the plane down, surface-to-air missiles. I don't think any building in the world is more heavily guarded than the Pentagon. Kind of stuff that goes on in that building.
Mm-hmm.
The Pentagon would have shot it down before it ever got close to the building. Well, of course, no missiles were launched to shoot it down because there was no threat. And, of course, if it was a missile, which it was, the scheme was to let the missile hit the Pentagon, to be part of the mass casualty event, to let all the things that happened post 9/11 follow. Another point. The 9/11 Whitewash Commission deleted Mineta's comment from its official report. Another point. Secret Service agents let Bush remain at the Sarasota, Florida school for 30 minutes after they learned the second tower was struck. It's supposed to be automatic that if there's any chance of danger to the president, you get him out of harm's way. Well, I would say knocking down two towers was certainly a potential danger that should have gotten Bush out of harm's way, but he stayed for 30 minutes.
Also endangering the students.
Endangering everybody, indeed. Yeah. He was reading a story to the students, and the Secret Service violated what they were supposed to do. They did not get him out of harm's way. Another point, jet fuel does not heat high enough to melt or cause rigid steel columns to crumble.
Mm-hmm.
It simply can't do it. How did the buildings come down? They were rigged on the inside with explosives. The explosives were detonated, and the buildings came down. That's the only way it could have happened. The only question is, what kind of explosives were used? There are some people who think nuclear explosives were used. I don't know, and I don't think conclusive information has come out either way. But the building definitely was rigged with explosives, just like the Murrow Building in Oklahoma City in the mid-1990s, blamed on two individuals. Whether they had any involvement or not, I don't know. But the truck that supposedly blew up the Murrow Building, the FBI building, literally did not do it. The building was rigged. There were many, many buildings in a vast area surrounding the Murrow Building that went down with the FBI building. And in this case, a study was done by an Air Force general at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and the results came out maybe a couple of months after the incident. And an Air Force general exposed the big lie and said a truck bomb did not bring down the building, but there was no such investigation after the 9/11 event. You had the 9/11 commission, but they were paid to lie, not expose the truth. So again, you had a big lie in the 1990s. You had a big lie following 9/11. The official story is entirely different. In Building 7, another big lie. The BBC, Jane Stanley, reported Building 7 coming down 30 minutes before it happened. I don't know whether the video is still circulating, but I saw Jane Stanley reporting Building 7 coming down 30 minutes before it happened, with an image of Building 7 in the background.
Still standing, right.
How the BBC could have done this, I don't know, but they did. So yeah. Another one of the big lies. Jane Stanley, I'm certain, will never live this down. There are so many other big lies. There is an initiative called Consensus 9/11. There are many, many remarkable people involved in it, including a woman who comes on my program, Elizabeth Woodworth. She's connected with David Ray Griffin. And they put together, using forensic evidence, key points that are virtually irrefutable because of the forensic work they do to detail the truth, to expose the official lies. I believe they've come up with 44 consensus points. And these consensus points literally take a specific 9/11 big lie and debunk it. The latest ones were the fact that the 7500 code wasn't activated, the fact that black boxes on the planes were found where they were buried before, and apparently information came out that they weren't found, but they were found. And if they were found, then why wasn't information on them made public? Information on them would go a further step to proving that the official story was a big lie. It goes on and on, Cheryl.
Yeah, right.
One big lie after another.
Now, in your article, you say that the American dream is more myth than reality, and quote George Carlin, who once said, quote, "You have to be asleep to believe it." Are most Americans still asleep, in your opinion? And if so, why do you think that is?
I think more and more Americans are waking up. Too many Americans are still asleep. But one of the things that encourages me greatly is the fact that cable news services, and I believe the broadcasters, are losing audiences. People are getting fed up with what I call managed news misinformation. They want the real thing. They want to know the truth. They want accuracy on the big issues of the day, major world and national ones, and they're sick and tired of being lied to, so they're tuning out. I guess they still watch other things. They watch movies. They watch the sitcoms. They watch these programs, but they're getting fed up with the daily fare, where it doesn't matter whether you turn on CNN or CBS or Fox, you're getting big lies one after another, and they repeat them. The New York Times, same thing. One big lie after another. If you want to know the truth, you've got to go to the alternative media. You've got to go where people will tell you what's going on and explain the things that people need to know. So it's wonderful if people will tune these broadcasters and cable channels out. It's the one industry in America that ordinary people can shut down by their activism. You can't shut down the defense contractors. You can't shut down the automobile makers. You can't shut down the chemical companies, but you can shut down the cable companies, and you can shut down the New York Times. Stop buying their publications. Stop reading them. Stop tuning in to news broadcasts on Fox, on CNN, on NBC. Don't watch. If enough people don't watch, there'll be no advertisers. If there are no advertisers, there'll be no programs, there'll be no news. And the only place people can go for the real thing is the alternative media, like this program, like my own program called the Progressive Radio News Hour, where they'll get the truth and all of the truth.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that is people power in action, and it's something we can all do very simply. Yeah, I appreciate that. Now, certainly the wars and occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan are directly resulting from 9/11. What about the destruction of Libya and the war in Syria? How is that related to 9/11, or is it?
Oh, they're all related to 9/11, Cheryl. Same thing, same pretext for going to war. Afghanistan, the attack on 9/11, which the Taliban had nothing to do with. The second war on Iraq, Bush's Iraq War II. Weapons of mass destruction that didn't exist. You couldn't pull off these big lies if you didn't have a reason to do it. And the reason is America's war on terror, protecting the American people from what I call non-existent threats. The only threats that America faces, Cheryl, are the ones it invents. There was no threat from Afghanistan, no threat from Iraq. There was no threat from Libya. Gaddafi, there were many fabrications about Gaddafi feeding his troops by Agra so that his forces could go out and rape women or slaughter the forces and do things like that. Again, one big lie after another. It was shocking what America did to Libya. Libya was an extraordinary country. The vast majority of Libyans supported Gaddafi. And why? Because he gave them the kind of country people like to live in. Libya was the most developed country in North Africa. You could say the same thing about Iraq. Both countries, extraordinarily developed countries, doing wonderful things for their people, providing them things in Libya and Iraq, free education, free health care, free other social services, getting things that Americans can't even imagine. Americans can't imagine getting these things for nothing. But Libyans got them under Gaddafi. Iraqis got them under Saddam. They're all gone because America wanted the countries destroyed, exploited, letting U.S. corporations in to run things. So waging a war on terror, fabricating big lies about how the country was run and the harm it was claimed these countries were doing to other nations in the region, to American forces in the region, became the pretext for going to war against them. It was true in Libya. It's true in Syria. I rightfully call Syria, Obama's war. Syria is Obama's war. He planned it. He waged it. It's got nothing to do with Assad waging war on his people. Nothing whatsoever. It's got everything to do with eliminating an independent leader. America tolerates none. It wants subservient pro-Western leaders it controls. Assad is independent. Obama wanted him removed. Same reason we wanted Saddam removed. Same reason we wanted the Taliban removed. Same reason we wanted Gaddafi removed. To get rid of these people, to put in pro-Western stooge governments, to let them run their countries to serve U.S. interests, corporate interests, imperial interests, and so on.
Does the fact that they had their own banks and weren't connected to the World Bank or any of the other Western banks, was that a part of why we wanted to get rid of those governments?
Oh, absolutely. One of the big crimes a country can commit against America is to trade outside of the dollar. Saddam was trading outside of the dollar in Iraqi currency. Same thing with Gaddafi in Libya. And this is a major no-no. The dollar, as the world's reserve currency, which it is now, is extremely important for America. It funds America's wars. It buys America's bonds. It keeps America's corporations strong. It does all of these things. And if the dollar loses its reserve currency status, then all of these benefits are lost. So if a country dares to trade in its own currency outside of the dollar, it gets targeted for regime change. That one offense alone gets it targeted for regime change.
Now, the situation with the group ISIS seemed to come out of nowhere. Could you help us make some sense of what's going on there with in Syria? You know, we have the rebels, then we have ISIS, and everybody seems to be fighting everybody. Maybe you could tell us who's supporting them and what that's all about.
Well, the most important thing to say about ISIS, Cheryl, is number one, it's a U.S. invention. America invented ISIS the same way as it invented the Mujahideen in the 1980s to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. And the Mujahideen then, whom Ronald Reagan called during a visit of their leaders to the Oval Office, the modern equivalent of our founding fathers, well, the equivalent of the Mujahideen today in Afghanistan is the Taliban. Same thing. So we see these things repeat. America created the Mujahideen, recruited them. America created Al-Qaeda. America created ISIS or ISIS or the Islamic State. There are many, many, you could call them terrorist organizations. I think that's an accurate way of describing them. There are many of them, small ones with names I don't even recognize, others with names I do recognize, like Al-Nusra. They're all over the region. I think new ones crop up all the time. Some of them are U.S. created. Others may just crop up on their own. But America very definitely is allied with them. The war on terror is part of using these groups to initiate America's agenda, which, of course, is regime change against independent governments, and to further what I call America's imperium, advancing America's goal toward unchallenged global dominance. And this is what America seeks. And it does it by getting these groups to attack foreign countries, the governments of which America wants eliminated, to establish its own control over these countries and regional dominance en route to global dominance. That's what the America agenda is.
In your article, 9/11, The Mother of All Big Lies, you state that America is on a fast-track to tyranny, perhaps just another false flag away. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, I believe it really is, and there are some people I respect very much that say America already has reached full-blown tyranny. One of the most obvious things are the domestic laws that passed in the wake of 9/11, and I wrote about them at the time. One of my early articles, Cheryl, I called Police State America, and I put a subtitle, I look back and ahead, but the Patriot Act, 4 weeks after 9/11, the Patriot Act literally eviscerated three or four of the Bill of Rights. The war on terrorism, a phony war. The war on terrorism is a war of state terrorism against the American people. That's what it really is. And nobody threatens America. There's no nation, there is no group that threatens America. And when Obama makes a statement that ISIL or Al-Qaeda or any other so-called terrorist group threatens America, people should be worried. Well, he's lying. There is no threat whatsoever.
And that was the first part of an interview with author Stephen Lendman. Tune in next week to hear the conclusion of that interview. You can read his articles on the website globalresearch.ca. And also he writes for moneynewsnow.com and for veteranstoday.com. He has a new book out called Flashpoint in Ukraine, which we'll discuss in more detail on next week's show. He also has a blog at www.sjlendman@blogspot.com. And Lendman is L-E-N-D-M-A-N. He also mentioned the fact that we were lied to about the Oklahoma City bombings. A few years back, we showed the movie A Noble Lie about the questions concerning the Oklahoma City bombing. But if you missed that, you can get the film online at www.anoblelie.com. Also, the website whatreallyhappened.org has some good information about the Oklahoma City bombing. And again, the website globalresearch.ca also has articles there posted about the Oklahoma City bombing. I also want to let you know about a new book by retired Canadian professor Graham McQueen. It's called The 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy. And you can get it at Clarity Press. I just started reading it, and I highly recommend it. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. We have three Stella workers who are engaged in a fast. They are Walmart workers and or former Walmart workers. And they are Denise Bartlage, former Walmart worker of 9 years who was laid off in Pico Rivera, California, after, hey, speaking out for better working conditions. And Tiffany Faulkner, former Walmart Consumer Service Manager from Sacramento, California, and Emily DeHart, who works for Walmart in Merritt Island, Florida, and as we figured out, right near Cape Canaveral. Welcome to Brooklyn, and I am thoroughly delighted to have you here. And to set the pace, why don't we listen to some sound from other Walmart workers? You'll get the idea.
Sometimes I can't buy my son clothes or shoes or buy groceries for the house.
Quite often I have to skip lunch. Other times I've had to miss work because I didn't have money to get there.
You got to pick and choose what you pay. You don't have the luxury of paying for everything that you need.
Day or two before payday, I'm already budgeting my check, which at that point in time, 2 days before I even get paid, I'm already broke. And that's not a cycle that, oh, it'll happen here and there. It's every paycheck.
I have grandchildren and great-grandchildren that I'm dying to meet, but I can't because I can't afford to.
Making $15 an hour would bring me out of poverty.
Making $15 an hour, I wouldn't have to stress about keeping my car insurance to be able to get to work.
I'd be able to buy the books I need to be able to go to college.
$15 an hour would mean that I could take care of my medical expenses.
If I made $15 an hour right now, I'd be able to afford a car again. I'd be able to afford rent. I'd be able to buy food without having to rely on welfare.
I wouldn't have to worry about checking up with friends. I would have my own place.
Join us.
Join us.
Únete para poder vivir mejor.
Stand up, let the company.
Join us so we can all live better.
So 15 and full-time work. We have three fasting workers here protesting the conditions at Walmart. Workers to organize dozens of events nationwide and outside Walton Family Estates to demonstrate that Walmart workers and their families are going hungry. Now, who wants to start and tell us what their own experiences have been and whether or not anything we've heard is a, what, exaggeration? So why don't we start with our sister from Pico Rivera, California, Denise Bartlage.
Being at Pico for 9 years, I did see a lot of injustice in that area, not just in retaliation or intimidation with managers, but a lot with the associates, what they had to face in that area of hunger. Many of them just sat at the back break room tables, just watching you or just lowering their heads. I have my husband who works. We had some difficulties ourselves, but nothing to what some of the associates went through. And a lot of times I felt if I had enough to give them, I either buy them a lunch or share my lunch in that category. I would also see at times when associates had to make choices about either getting gas or finding a way home because they didn't have gas in their car, not enough for a bus pass, or to eat. a lot of times, a lot of us would just combine our efforts together to give rides home, or just we worked as a family to assist people because Walmart didn't care. Walmart did not care. This is a company, the largest private employer in the world. Not only did they have the situation of not being able to show sympathy in this area, that if you needed to draw government assistance, you could go to the personnel office to receive those papers. I mean, what's that telling you about a company like that?
Walmart claims to be a family, but we're more of a family to each other than they are. Like, we donate food to each other. We share our lunches. We bring food from home for each other. And, you know, it's sad when, you know, people are starving at work and feel the need to steal someone's lunch out the refrigerator. And I know that's happened to Denise a couple times. You know, daily across the nation, you have Walmart workers who, like me, when I was working there with a friend, we would combine our money and our food stamps. And, you know, she'd spend the last of her food stamps buying a loaf of bread.
Wait a minute. You worked at Walmart and you also were getting food stamps?
Yes, a lot of people, you know, they're not me personally, but like people that have families, you know, being a single parent, there's a lot of workers at Walmart that are eligible for food stamps. Why does the country and our nation have to subsidize Walmart workers when Walmart is the number one richest employer of the world and profits $16 billion in 1 year?
So that's a good question. So Tiffany raised it. Do tell us, Emily.
I'm also a person that has food stamps. And not only food stamps, but I have WIC now because I have a two-month-old son. So therefore, I do know the struggle. And when my husband goes to work, sometimes he's not able to have lunch because they obviously don't give us enough food stamps and we don't make enough with me when I was out of work. So, yeah, Walmart's pretty unfair with their stuff, but along with the state, they tell us we make too much sometimes, so we do go hungry a lot.
Aside from the food issues and the wage issues, what about the working conditions? Surely they must be more beneficent in terms of consideration. They're not sexist, they're not racist, they're not xenophobic, they're considerate of the needs, the health and safety. Well, I'm being a little bit tongue-in-cheek here because clearly I know that's not the case. But tell us about those as well.
I mean, they don't care about working people's families. They expect you to have open availability from be available from 6 a.m. to midnight or whatever the time the store closes. If you close your availability, they cut your hours. How do people with families survive like that? Imagine raising a young child and having to work at Walmart and not being able to help your child with homework or anything like that.
Tiffany, you mentioned cutting hours, part-time work, because that's one of the key demands. Do you want to talk to that?
Yes. So most of the workers at Walmart are part-timers. Very few are full-time. If you're full-time, you're a member of management or a long-term associate that's been there long enough before they started cutting part-timers. But it's hard to live even at full-time, like I was being a customer service manager, off of $11.40 an hour in California. And I know a lot of people have it worse than I do, but that was a struggle for me, being single by myself. Making $11.40 wasn't enough when you have rent that's like $700. And I can imagine how hard it is when you're only part-time and trying to still make your bills and take care of a family.
Well, what I also want to know is, what about those conditions? They treat you with respect, with dignity. What if somebody's hurt on the job? They get, hey, decent vacation pay, sick leave. What's going on with that as well?
Well, in California, we were able to establish a sick time policy, which Walmart does not like. It was addressed to temps as well as part-time workers. In California, how it's set up, for every 30 hours you work, you get 1 hour of sick time pay. Walmart's changing a lot of their policy regarding that, trying to oversee that law from their policy. It's going to come back on them. But a lot of associates are appreciative of that. But, you know, again, we have situations where Walmart doesn't even abide by their own policies. One of their things is about the two-man lift. Many associates who had to lift items that were over 50 pounds, associates would try to find it, would tell them, I can't lift it by myself. Management was, well, just trying to find help. A lot of people who were skeptic about giving help because they didn't want to lose their department, they knew that they could be coached or fired. So a lot of associates didn't really assist each other in those capabilities. So a lot of people would get hurt, sent to what we call the no-care clinic operated by through Walmart. And many people would just be given an aspirin and a Band-Aid.
The no-care clinic?
Yep.
Is that tongue-in-cheek or is that?
Yeah, pretty much. Okay. Pretty much. Mm. And a lot of people were sent back to work and went from there.
And Emily, you were recently injured on the job also. Do you want to talk about that and what management's attitude toward that were?
I wasn't actually injured on the job, but I did hurt my foot about a year ago. And they had told me to go home because I had crutches. And I was willing to work. I was ready. And I went home and came back a few days later, and they actually coached me for it, which isn't fair at all because they told me to go home.
They coached you for it?
It's kind of like a write-up.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they coached me for it, and that's where I finally dropped.
So you got you got a write-up because they told you to go home because you had crutches.
Yeah, they found out the liability.
You know, Sam and Alice Walton, my goodness.
I want to reinstate something on that injury part, something that we were able to instill in the laws, and that was which was called respect the bump. A lot of young moms who were at Walmart, a lot of them lost miscarriages due to Walmart not seeing it as a disability and not giving limitations on their job abilities, and Walmart just didn't care. So a lot of Walmart workers, Tiffany especially even, we got together when there was a petition drawn on that, and it was called Save the Bump. And many Walmart women now have the ability to stop for a while and not have to pick up heavy things. Because it wasn't Walmart, they wouldn't have never had done that. It was many workers who instilled that.
But I heard a commercial, as a matter of fact, just before I came to the radio station, talking about the enormous increases in wages and how beneficent Walmart was to its workers. So what do we say to Walmart? And I know you folks have been saying a heck of a lot.
The recent wage increases were a start, but that was not enough. For workers in California and a lot of other areas, they didn't see anything. And, you know, like in California, the minimum wage is already $9, so they got skipped. Next year it's going to 10. They're going to get skipped again. We want to get raises for everyone, not just for some. And, you know, we have long-term associates that don't see anything either. They've been capped and not getting raises, and they're not making that much. It's a show that Walmart's putting on saying that our wages are good, but they're not. And it shows proof when a lot of the workers are on government assistance. Why should we be working for Walmart and still be on government assistance? Something's wrong.
Well, indeed, something's wrong, but something's very, very right here, because my sisters are all sitting here with bright lime green shirts. And, of course, there's the kind of O and the W, that the insignia there, and it says OurWalmartForRespect.org. Now, you folks have vowed and begun a hunger strike, and I want to know more about who you are that caused you to take this stand. It's courageous. It's dignified. It's what workers historically have done to move forward, but it's not easy. So tell us how the hunger strike, the FAST, came into being and why the three of you joined it. Who wants to begin? Okay, we're starting with our Pico store here. We're going back to Denise.
I've done other fasting before, three of them this year. You know, the thing about fasting, it always calls to attention. Everyone recognizes when there's fasting, as it did in Tiananmen Square and in Gandhi. It really raises attention to what's going on in a situation, as it did for us back in April for L.A. County, when we were able to fast with many other great women that I did that were fasting for Raise the Wage campaign in L.A. City. And eventually the mayor took notice and signed off on that.
And my sister from Florida, what brought you into this process? I mean, you've just had a new baby. Your life is, I dare say, full and hectic. And here you are traveling throughout the country, saying, really giving comeuppance, if you will, to Walmart. $15 full-time hours. What brought you to this?
Unfortunately, I'm not fasting. I should tell you that now. My husband is. He's here with me.
Well, that's okay.
He's fasting for me. What brought me here, I would like to support the people that are. And obviously, I've been through not having lunch and stuff like that. So it really does touch base for me. So I support everybody that does it.
Tiffany.
I'm fasting to support the Walmart workers across the country who either go without lunch or having to share money for lunch. It's a problem across the country that needs to end, and we're out here to draw attention to it, being out front of the Waltons estates across the country, saying, hey, pay attention to us. This needs to stop.
Denise, you worked at the Pico Rivera store, and that was closed for a while on curious conditions and just recently reopened, and you weren't taken back, and a number of other workers weren't taken back also. Do you want to talk about that?
Pico Rivera's store, the first store that ever striked. It was a little heartfelt in every which way. I remember the day that it closed, April the 13th of this year. A great deal of associates, I'm sure many people saw it online, how some associates were just dropped down in tears. They didn't know when to anticipate. Again, a lot of our single moms, a lot of people who, even though their checks might have been very small, it was their checks, and they relied on that for whatever cause they need for food and all. And, you know, as my good friend Evelyn Cruz always said, they didn't just lay off 530 people. They laid off 530 families. And that's something that we have to keep in note. You know, it's not just the workers, but their families that are get involved in this as well, that take heart to this. You know, I've been very active with our Walmart for 5 years, so it comes to no surprise that they haven't reinstated me yet. But I believe that down the line that they will hopefully do the right thing. We can only hope for that and see what happens. But a lot of associates that we've been able to have food banks for them and help them out in every which way.
But I will say that store closing had a tremendous effect across all members of our Walmart. For me personally, I was part of the sit-in that happened in November. And to know that a store that we took over and actually sat in got closed down for quote-unquote plumbing issues, you know, was really heartbreaking for the organization as a whole. And to know that that was our number one store, our kickoff store, it was very heartbreaking to a lot of us.
Oh, Tiffany, just tell us a little bit more about what led to the strike there, because I'm not sure that all of our listeners know that our sisters and brothers from Walmart stores, some of them have actually mobilized and have struck, and of course the Pico store did. Tell us a little bit more about the takeover of that store and the strike. That's back, you said, in November. That was pretty exciting. Talk about it.
So last year, about this time, actually, maybe today exactly, about this week, this year, we decided that we're going to kick off our Black Friday actions by doing a sit-in in retaliation. So it was all of California, members from across California, going down to Southern California, and we actually did sit-ins in two different stores, the Crenshaw store and the Pico Rivera store. That was such a powerful movement for those of us that did it. We took over the Crenshaw store for 2 hours. They didn't know what to do. It showed how powerful we were to see management scrambling around, looking crazy like, oh, my God, what do we do? Denise, you got anything to add to that?
And by the way, I've got to hear some of the chants, too. We're not leaving without chants. So I want you to get your voices in unison here.
You know, I give it up to my girl, Venancy, who led us on that chant to opening in Crenshaw, because she was actually the starting of the store at Pico to getting people signed up, and it was just a ripple effect after that. One of the things was that she stood strong saying the chant, getting us moved on into Crenshaw and being a leader in that store with us. But yeah, it was wonderful to see, because it was a big surprise. More so for the home office of HR and all them coming in there and telling us we couldn't be there. Who do we think we are? We only could be current associates to be there. We all identified ourselves as current associates. Had a lawyer there at that point who very calmly said, we have the right to be here. Here were papers. So at one point, as we're sitting there on the floor with green tape on our mouths that said strike or no retaliation, we showed them that we demanded our rights. We showed them.
Now, you're in New York, and you did an action today. You paid a courtesy call on Alice Walton. She has a little condo here on Park Avenue. I think she paid $25 million for it.
So, oh, patash.
Well, for her it is, yeah. So.
Yes.
Anybody want to talk? Did she come down and offer you breakfast or anything? This was at 9 o'clock in the morning.
No, she didn't. She didn't make her presence, but we made our presence known for sure. But yes, we're going to be doing that all week. We're going to be making our presence known, saying, hey, Alice Walton, pay attention to us. Workers need, you know, consistent full-time and $15 an hour because we're starving. Everyday workers are starving, and we're going to be out there all week to say, hey, this needs to stop.
Emily, one of the things I'm interested in is it's 15 and full time. Tell us a little bit about how the hours are structured and why the demand is so you don't get full time hours. Is that the issue? It's only part time. What's the significance of the demand for 15 and full time?
Yeah, there's a lot of people that don't get full-time unless you're management or you work overnights.
The way Walmart does it is if they increase the wages like they just did, they have a tendency to cut hours. So that's why we're saying 15 and consistent full-time, so that they can't cut the hours.
I want to reiterate on something, too. Walmart's old policy always stated that they would always keep in their stores 70% full-time, 30% part-time. That's turned around. That's completely turned around on them. I think they're hurting themselves and their business. It's not just bad that they already have a bad karma out there, but also by not providing decent service by doing that, by cutting the hours, they're actually hurting themselves more than they know of. So what do we want our listeners and what do we want New Yorkers to know and all the 50 states where there are demonstrations all for the rights and the working conditions of hardworking, dignified, wonderful people like yourselves. Members of the working class who, what do you know? You all create all the wealth. So what's the message to Walmart? What are you and your husband, who is fasting, and I'm sure you don't throw that up to him, you know, we're not going to Katz's and getting any pastrami sandwiches while he's fasting. But what's the message that you want everybody to know?
We want 15 and full time so that we're not on, you know, financial assistance from the state, so that we can provide for our family and not have to struggle with bills and rent and all that stuff.
And what do you think about the Alice Waltons of the Walmart world? You know, this is just one of her luxury estates that you were protesting in front of. What do you think about the Alice Waltons of the world?
That really makes me sick, the way she, not just her, but all the Waltons. They make so much money, and they can't share it with us. They're really stingy. I don't like that.
Now, these are 15 days of protest leading up to what, Tiffany?
So this is 15 days of actions leading up to Black Friday, where across the nation there will be actions for and protests on Black Friday. If you would like to start or join an action for Black Friday, you can sign up at protest.blackfriday. And I know we have actions going on across the nation.
So we're going to do that one more time. Where do people go to find out where they can join you folks in participating? Where do they go? What's that website?
It's protest.blackfriday.com. Black Friday.
Now, wait a minute. I said you're not getting out of here without at least one slogan. Do we have some chance?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to do a 1, 2, 3. I want to hear 1, 2, 3.
Who's Walmart?
Our Walmart.
Who's Walmart?
Our Walmart.
I like it. I like it. Are there some other ones, too? Anything about Alice? Come on. Oh, you're getting shy now. Wait a minute. Somebody is actually pulling something out of her bag now. That's Tiffany. But you were prompting her, Emily, so you were a bit shy before. But what's up?
I'm trying to remember it, but I think it goes, Alice. You can't hide. We can see your greedy side.
Oh, I like that. Okay, 1, 2, 3. Tiffany, we need you over here. 1, 2, 3. Okay, Alice,
you can't hide. We can see your greedy side.
Did some of the neighbors come out and identify with you folks in front of her home while you were chanting that?
Yeah, there's actually, I think she may have been a cleaning lady or something. She was actually taking pictures of us.
Well, I think you should feel enormously proud of yourselves, and we are there. And Alice, you can't hide. We do see your greedy side. And you know something? The workers of this country, and indeed the workers of the world, are going to make sure that our sisters and brothers have at least 15 full-time hours, and a heck of a lot of other things are going to change with Walmart, right?
Yes.
So, again, you are?
I'm Emily from Merritt Island.
And I'm Tiffany from Sacramento.
And Denise from Pico Rivera, California.
Want to give one final comment about what we all should know? And I see the beautiful green button, too. We're all holding up. You can't all see this. But we're holding up our hands now with the zero and the W. And that stands for?
Our Walmart.
And that is the national campaign that's going to make. Hey, you're going to unionize, too. Without a doubt, I think your green shirts, I think your spirit, your energy, and the sacrifices you made are admirable. And it is an absolute delight to welcome you to Brooklyn, to our studios, and we are absolutely with you.
Thank you.
And again, we've been speaking with our fasters and sympathizers, and they are Denise Barlage and Tiffany Faulkner, Emily DeHart, and they are fighting for what Walmart really should give to the workers who have created their wealth. Thank you. For all of you. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
I stopped going to church a year ago because just the attitude towards minorities and homosexuals and women.
Romans chapter 1, verse 32, the Apostle Paul does say that homosexuals are worthy of death. His words, not mine!
I'm mourning. I'm pointing out the problem. It's not a gay time.
I would like to introduce to you a candidate for the President of the United States, Senator Ted Cruz.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. The Australian Senate pans the government's marriage equality plebiscite, same-gender families and friends lead a new Mormon migration, and GOP hopefuls woo a kill the gays gadfly. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending November 14, 2015. Australia's Senate has given thumbs down to the ruling coalition government's plans to hold a costly national referendum on opening civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples. Green Party Senator Robert Sims introduced the motion, which passed on a voice vote this week with no exact tally taken. Reporters said a loud and clear majority voted in favor. Australians don't want another opinion poll on this issue, Sims said. They want the parliament to legislate. That won't happen as long as new Liberal Party Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull maintains his predecessor Tony Abbott's refusal to allow coalition MPs a free vote on a marriage equality bill. LGBT advocates have voiced fears that such an election campaign will also create increased opportunities for verbal and perhaps even violent expressions of anti-LGBT hate. The proposal now goes to Australia's House of Representatives, where its fate is uncertain.
A gay couple who legally wed in England is suing their Northern Ireland homeland to have the marriage legally recognized there. It's treated only as a civil partnership because Northern Ireland doesn't recognize the civil marriages of same-gender couples legally performed elsewhere, and the government continues to resist domestic marriage equality. In a fifth effort to open civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples in the past 3 years, a first-ever majority vote in the Assembly in favor was overturned by the ruling Democratic Unionist Party, which Northern Ireland law allows. The filing by the unnamed gay couple, referred to only in the singular as X's petition, asks the family court in Belfast to declare that X and his husband are legally married in their home country. John O'Doherty of the LGBT advocacy Rainbow Project told reporters that it is really that simple. It is without precedent that a married person stops being married when they travel to different parts of the UK. X's petition has launched what's expected to be a long legal battle. A different lawsuit filed earlier this year by Northern Ireland same-gender couples seeks an upgrade from the civil partnerships they entered into to civil marriage. A 2-day hearing is scheduled in the High Court for December 3rd and 4th.
A lesbian couple in Costa Rica used a government clerical error to get married. The 24-year-old birth certificate of Yasmin Elizondo erroneously lists her as male. Even though civil marriages of same-gender couples are banned in the Central American country, Elizondo married Laura Flores Estrada in July. There are no wedding bouquets coming from the government, though. Luis Bolaños, the civil registry director, filed a criminal complaint this week against Elizondo, her currently legally wed spouse, and their lawyer, seeking to annul the marriage. We believe that these people were aware that a marriage between people of the same sex warrants a complaint, Bolaños said, adding that parts of the criminal code might have been broken. The couple and their lawyer vow to vigorously fight the complaint.
Meanwhile, lawmakers in Ukraine have decided that a European travel pass has made it worthwhile to ban employment discrimination against LGBT people. The rocky journey through Parliament this week of a bill to do that included 5 attempts to bring it up for a vote and a second rejection on November 11th. But a narrow majority of MPs finally voted the following day to amend Ukraine's labor code to add sexual orientation and gender identity to a host of other characteristics protected from workplace discrimination. As a result of the amendment to protect LGBT people, Ukrainians will soon be able to join a program that offers visa-free travel throughout the European Union. It also moves the country closer to the EU membership it seeks. Lawmakers passed the measure only after getting assurances that marriage equality will never be proposed in the former Soviet satellite. Volodymyr Groysman, the parliament speaker, said that, "God forbid this to happen, and we will never support it."
In other news, and facing a firestorm of outrage, The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, issued what it called clarifications this week of changes to its handbook that were announced last week. Those changes include the possible excommunication of legally married same-gender couples for apostasy, violating church tenets, and refusing baptism to the children of those couples until they're at least 18, and then only if they disavow same-gender unions. According to a Mormon media statement on November 13th, membership or priesthood privileges for children who are already baptized, active in the church, and living with married same-gender couples won't be affected by the handbook updates. It also stressed that any baptism decisions at the local level should be made with the best interests of the child in mind. That didn't seem to stem the tide of pending resignations from the church, however, sparked mostly by the seemingly punitive threats against the children of married same-gender Mormon couples. Kate Kendall, the executive director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, was raised Mormon. She announced in a Washington Post op-ed this week that she's formally quitting the church, citing the cruel new policy that she says punishes children of LGBT parents.
You may have heard about a Utah judge who ordered a baby removed from the home of her married lesbian foster parents solely because of their sexual orientation.
We've been told to care for this child like a mother would, and I am her mother. I mean, that's who she knows.
That's one of the lesbian foster moms, April Hogland. She and her wife, Becky Pierce, were legally married a year ago and have cared for the 9-month-old baby girl for the past 3 months. But Judge Scott N. Johansson of Utah's juvenile court ordered the child to be placed with a heterosexual foster couple because he claimed research shows that it is not in the best interest of children to be raised by same-sex couples. However, every credible scientific study has concluded that the sexual orientation of the parents plays no role in the development and well-being of a child.
When they asked to show his research, he would not.
Hoagland and Pierce were planning to legally adopt the girl with the support of the child's birth mother, the child's state-appointed attorney, and the Utah Division of Child and Family Services. There were no allegations of neglect or wrongdoing. After even Utah's conservative Republican Governor Gary Herbert said Johansson had gone too far, the judge temporarily rescinded his removal order and scheduled a hearing to determine the best interest of the child for December 4th. The Salt Lake Tribune noted that Johansson has been repeatedly reprimanded by the State Judicial Conduct Commission for demeaning the judicial office.
In last week's overwhelming voter repeal in Houston of HERO, the Texas city's LGBT-inclusive anti-discrimination ordinance, opponents used fear during the campaign to specifically target the T, no men in women's bathrooms. But a defiantly unanimous Dallas City Council pointedly voted this week to add gender identity and expression to the city's existing anti-bias laws that already include sexual orientation. The people behind the successful scare tactic-laden repeal effort in Houston have already set their sights on Dallas. One of them, Jared Woodfill, told the Houston Chronicle that they're prepared to use the same transphobic fear-mongering to overturn Dallas's protections for all LGBT people.
And finally, the ubiquitous Seattle, Washington-based Starbucks coffee chain was in the news this week for two different reasons. The multinational bean peddler has joined forces with Seattle's police department to turn 97 of its home city locations into safe places for LGBT people. The program will train 2,000 Seattle-area Starbucks employees on how to properly report homophobic or transphobic hate crimes to the police. Jim Ritter, an openly gay Seattle police officer and the department's LGBT community liaison, told the Seattle Times that anti-LGBT thugs are cowards for the most part. They do their damage and leave. They like operating in the shadows, and Safe Place eliminates a lot of those shadows. Starbucks has a long history of support for LGBT equality, but the second reason the company was in the news this week involved its new holiday season coffee containers. They're bright red with a dark green Starbucks logo, and as always, they come with your name handwritten on them. But that's apparently not Christmassy enough for the coffee vendor's artificial, controversy-creating far-right critics. Popular TV talk show host Ellen DeGeneres explains.
Over the weekend, Starbucks introduced their new holiday cups, and what I'm about to show you is highly offensive. Brace yourselves. Here it is. You can tell it's mine because it says Eileen with three N's. People are mad about this cup because they're saying Starbucks is being anti-Christmas. The old cups had snowflakes and Santa's sleigh and elves. You know, all the things that you find in the Bible. And now they're just red. And, I mean, look at this cup. You might as well call it a Satan sipper, is what you... People are so upset. So Starbucks released a statement about their cups. They said that belonging, inclusion, and diversity are the core values of Starbucks, and Starbucks wants to give customers an experience that inspires the spirit of the season. How dare they?
That's News Wrap for the week ending November 14th, 2015. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm John Dyer V.
After giving Mormon LGBT people and their supporters a ray of hope by admitting that its adherents need to respect the U.S. Supreme Court's decision on marriage equality, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints dealt them a crushing blow on November 5th. A revised church handbook banned baptism for the children of same-gender parents, adding that those children could be baptized when they turn 18, provided they renounce their parents' marriages. In response, several hundred people rallied in Salt Lake City on November 14th to renounce the faith. At last count, more than 1,500 people have formally resigned their church membership. Steve Holbrook of the group Post-Mormon and Friends helped organize the rally.
So what's going on here is we're supporting masses of people who have decided that they no longer want to have their name associated with the LDS Church, particularly around the policy change that seemed to scrutinize against LGBT people. We've got a lawyer here who actually helps expedite the process of removing your name from the church. And forms and lots of people to support people. There's a big line here. The turnout's pretty amazing. The church I was raised in, it was a wonderful upbringing. But we just disagree with some of the directions the church has been going in.
Aaron Linford explained why he was formally leaving the church.
I stopped going to church religiously a year ago because just the attitude towards minorities and homosexuals and women. I'm ecstatic that there are so many people here. On the Facebook group, there were over 700 people coming. And that's amazing to me. My brother was the first to leave, and then he left a few years ago. And then my other brother left last year and kind of took me with him. So it's mostly just my parents now.
How do your parents feel about your decision?
I haven't told them yet. I'm going to tell them tonight.
Rich Kane recorded Steve Holbrook and Aaron Linford at the city's mass Mormon resignation rally for the Salt Lake Tribune website.
Hey. I'm Ellen DeGeneres, and you're listening to This Way Out. That was without cue cards, people.
When he started planning his Freedom 2015 National Religious Liberties Conference, Internet evangelical radio host Kevin Swanson probably thought that the presence of conservative Republican presidential hopefuls would bring both attendees and the press to his November 6th and 7th event in Des Moines, Iowa. However, the politicians who showed up may have been relieved that most of the mainstream media ignored the conference, despite Swanson's incredibly inflammatory remarks. One of the few who did take note was MSNBC's Rachel Maddow, who highlighted what she called the Kill the Gays conference on her program this week. Our coverage includes additional comments on Swanson's theological pronouncements by This Way Out associate producer Lucia Chappelle, who also serves as the social justice minister at Founders Metropolitan Community Church in Los Angeles.
There are families whose, and we're talking Christian families, pastors' families, elders' families, in good godly churches, their sons are rebelling, hanging out with homosexuals, and getting married. And the parents are invited. What would you do if that was the case? Here's what I would do. Sackcloth and ashes at the entrance to the church. And I'd sit in cow manure. And I'd spread it all over my body. That's what I would do. And I'm not kidding. I'm not laughing. I'm grieving. I'm mourning. I'm pointing out the problem. It's not a gay time. These are the people with the sores, the gaping sores. The sores that are pussy and gross, and people are coming in and carving happy faces on the sores. That's not a nice thing to do. Don't you dare carve happy faces on open, pussy sores. Don't you ever do that. Don't you ever do that. I tell you, don't do it. Sackcloth and ashes. This is what America needs. America needs to hear the message. We are messed up.
That's a pastor named Kevin Swanson. He hosted an event this weekend in Des Moines, Iowa. They called it the National Religious Liberties Conference. Over 1,700 people attended. And a pretty major theme of the event, both in terms of the literature that was available at the event and the way the hosts of the conference spoke from the stage, a significant theme was the practical challenges and the timing of how exactly and when exactly the United States of America should start rounding up gay people in this country in order to execute them. Because the appropriate punishment for the crime of being gay is that the government should have you killed.
Yes, Leviticus 20:13 calls for the death penalty for homosexuals. Yes, Romans chapter 1, verse 32, the Apostle Paul does say that homosexuals are worthy of death. His words, not mine. And I am not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I am not ashamed of the truth of the Word of God. And I am willing to go to jail for standing on the truth of the Word of God. Many have told me this weekend, you be careful. You choose your words carefully. We have presidentials coming down to this conference this weekend. I understand that. But I am not ashamed of the truth of the Word of God. And I'm willing to go to jail for it.
Of course, nobody is being threatened with jail for their religious beliefs. But standing on the truth of the Word of God can be no easy trick. Preachers like Swanson tend to be highly selective when it comes to the enforcement of the laws in the book of Leviticus. For example, while Leviticus 20:13 has been interpreted as prescribing death by stoning for sex acts between men, verses 10 through 12 demand the same penalty for adultery. Blasphemers should also be stoned to death, according to Leviticus, and so should children who curse their parents.
Then they asked me, yes, but do you advocate for our civil leaders to do this today? And my answer is no. But why? Here's why.
because that's not such a big deal. We are not to fear those who can kill the body. Yea, Jesus says, fear rather the one who can cast body and soul in hell forever. The discussion concerning the capital punishment of homosexuals is nothing. Is not all that important when contrasted with hellfire forever. You say, why wouldn't you call for it? I say it's because we need some time for homosexuals to repent. That's why they need time to repent. Do you understand? America needs time to repent. You say, why don't you call for it? America needs time to repent of their homosexuality, their adultery, and their porn addictions. America is steeped in a destructive form of sexuality. And friends, they're bound for hell. Do you understand? It's not so much an issue of the death penalty, it's an issue of God's judgment that's hanging upon this nation today.
The popular image of hell resembles Dante's Inferno more than anything in the Bible. Jesus was far more interested in talking about heaven on earth as well as afterwards. He also recognized the separation of church and state. Jesus barely escaped being stoned by mobs of religious conservatives himself more than once, and he was executed for sedition by the Roman government, egged on by the Jewish establishment, who feared that his movement would bring about the ruin of their nation.
So this is an event in Des Moines, Iowa, this weekend, at which three Republican presidential candidates made appearances. And those are not like the, you know, the kill the gays ravings of the guy who was hosting this event from some time in his past. This is not something that we dug up that he said a long time ago that maybe these presidential candidates didn't know about. This was actually the host of the event speaking this weekend. This was him speaking this weekend at the event where these three Republican presidential candidates were also present and speaking with him.
He's a humble man. He's a Christian man. And he joins us now, Governor Mike Huckabee, running for President of the United States. Come on up here. I would like to introduce to you a candidate for the President of the United States. Ladies and gentlemen, the Governor of Louisiana, Governor Bobby Jindal. Now, my friends, let me introduce to you the next candidate for the office of President of the United States. Folks, please make welcome Senator Ted Cruz.
Bobby Jindal, Mike Huckabee, Ted Cruz all appeared this weekend at this anti-gay confab in Des Moines, Iowa. And I don't think it can be said that these candidates didn't know what they were getting themselves into. On Thursday, the day before he went to this event, Ted Cruz was interviewed on CNN and was asked on CNN if it was appropriate for him to be going to this event with this pastor, given the stated views of this pastor about gay people. Senator Cruz responded to those questions on CNN by saying,
listen, I don't know what this gentleman has said and what he hasn't said.
This is the highest level, the very highest level of clarity, where the Word of God has spoken, both Old Testament and New Testament, ought not to be any debate whatsoever about it. And you know what that sin is? It's a sin of homosexuality. Romans 1, 1 Corinthians chapter 6, 1 Timothy, I think it's chapter 4, and of course Leviticus 18, Leviticus 20. The Word of God speaks there both, and in fact in Romans chapter 1, Paul affirms that this particular sin is worthy of death in Romans chapter 1.
There's actually quite a lot of debate about interpreting the few isolated passages of Scripture that Swanson cites. Biblical writers had no concept of sexual orientation, and their real concern was with sexual practices related to pagan worship. And while Swanson may limit his zeal to homosexuality, Leviticus also lists eating shellfish and rare steak and wearing mixed linen as abominations. Likewise, the 20 kinds of wrongdoers who deserve to die in Romans 1 include gossips, slanderers, the malicious, the haughty, the boastful, and the foolish. So some preachers might take heed.
Some of what happened at this event this weekend in Iowa was more run-of-the-mill, you know, culture war, religious right fire and brimstone stuff. There were denunciations of Harry Potter. There was a big, long soliloquy about the evils of a movie called How to Train Your Dragon. There was a big screaming denunciation of how country music radio stations need to repent, 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 because they've gone over to the gay side, too. But it really was a kill the gays call to arms. This religious liberties conference in Iowa this weekend, and there were pamphlets about why gay people should be executed. There were multiple discussions about it from the stage. There were at least two other speakers besides the host of the event who have publicly called for gay people to be executed. There was discussion at the event by people who have described the finite differences between the different methods of execution that should be used to kill people. Should they be thrown off cliffs? Should they be stoned to death? Apparently both of those are sanctioned means of execution for the crime of being gay. And again, this host of the event, who interviewed three Republican presidential candidates on stage, who convened the entire event, he has spoken in the past about the need to execute gay people in order to live in a properly Christian society. He talked about that repeatedly this weekend at the same event from the same stage that these candidates appeared. Part of the way all three of them are campaigning for president is by attending a Kill the Gays rally, convened this weekend at the Hy-Vee Hall in Des Moines, Iowa. And I don't know if that is considered to be a scandal anymore in Republican politics.
That was MSNBC's Rachel Maddow reacting to the politics of Kevin Kill the Gays, just not now Swanson, and the participation of three Republican presidential wannabes at his National Religious Liberties Conference this week in Des Moines, Iowa. And Display Out associate producer and MCC activist Lucia Chappelle with the theology. With additional thanks to Right Wing Watch for watching Swanson. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, John Dyer V, Michael LeBeau, and Lucia Chappelle contributed program material with thanks, as always, to Steve Pride. Bronski Beat performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For associate producer Lucia Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org, on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher, and on KEOS College Station, Texas, WOOL Bellows Falls, Vermont, 5KIX Kangaroo Island, South Australia, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station.
How dare they?
Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Today on Against the Grain, lobbying group, aggressive litigator, political power broker, and media campaigner. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is all that and more. Yet its tremendous influence doesn't get the attention it merits, promoting corporate interests on behalf of anonymous donor companies. I'm Sasha Lilly. Journalist Alyssa Katz joins me to discuss the immense power of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The business class has always had great power within the U.S. political system, but that power increased even further over the last several decades. A key actor in that change is an organization that often conjures to mind local associations benignly sponsoring highways, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. My guest today argues that it is the single most influential organization in American politics outside of the Republican and Democratic parties, anonymously championing the interests of some of the most polluting and anti-worker corporations in the country. I'm joined by investigative journalist Alyssa Katz, and her new book is titled The Influence Machine, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Corporate Capture of American Life, published by Spiegel and Grau. She's also the author of Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us. Alyssa, I wonder if you could explain why you assert that the power of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is only dwarfed by the two main political parties.
I make that claim because really there is no other organization other than the Chamber of Commerce that has made its influence felt in on the multiple levers of Washington politics. I mean, you certainly have other groups and enterprises and networks. I mean, clearly the Koch brothers and their networks, clearly Karl Rove organizations, a bunch of others that will either focus solely on or primarily on electoral politics and getting friends elected. You have many large lobbying groups of different stripes that focus on influencing members of Congress once they're elected. But what you have in the chamber is a very strategic and coordinated effort to press multiple levers on behalf of member businesses, and to do it in a coordinated way to ensure that policies and laws that those businesses believe will negatively affect them do not get through. The chamber is the biggest lobbyist by far, just in terms of the dollars spent. It hires numerous law firms in D.C. as well as employing its own staff to do that lobbying. So we're talking about a group that has spent more on lobbying in the past 15, 20 years than the National Association of Realtors, than the American Medical Association, than General Electric. I mean, it is by far the biggest. It's spent over $1 billion. And on top of its efforts to influence elections and to lobby those whom it helps to elect, the chamber also has a very aggressive litigation wing that, you know, if, you know, by some event laws and regulations do emerge that are objectionable to its funders, they will go out and fight to the bitter end in the courts to make sure that those laws and regulations don't move forward. It doesn't always work, and the chamber does not always win, but it's that integrated influence which is really unique and why I make that claim.
You've started to answer this, but I wonder if you could expand on how does the Chamber of Commerce operate? You mentioned lobbying, you mentioned litigation. Are there other mechanisms through which it operates?
Well, I think notably the chamber has been for at least a decade a leading purveyor and really a pioneering purveyor of what we would call dark money in elections. The chamber is legally a nonprofit organization. It's a trade association that's registered with the Internal Revenue Service. Really, from the time that Congress passed the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reforms, you know, in 2002, that severely restricted what was called soft money to the political parties and really tightened campaign finance caps and disclosures and a lot of other things, the chamber began to put itself out there as a repository for businesses that wanted to influence elections and no longer have the channels through the political parties to do that. The chamber hung out, basically hung out a shingle and said, okay, we're here and we're going to push the law to the fullest extent possible to make sure that we can continue to, that you can continue to support advertising and particularly attack ads to challenge incumbents in Congress who you think don't represent your interests. And so what they are doing is a gigantic end run around the established campaign finance system, the Federal Election Commission. And this was, before Citizens United, which, the chamber played a role in advancing practices and court rulings and challenges and so forth that led the way to Citizens United. But, in the process of doing that, they took enormous amounts of anonymous money from, we do not know who these donors are, and put them into attack ads that slowly but surely through the 2002, 2004, through the 2010 election cycles, first flipped the House of Representatives to Republican control. The chamber was a really leading player in making sure that happened. And then in 2014 to do the same for the Senate. And the chamber has said, look, we're a nonprofit. We can take money to merely educate voters. That's what we're here to do. We're not, this is not political activity. Or if it, to the extent we are involved in political activity, we're, simply doing this as, part of representing our members and advancing their interests. And so the chamber has spent hundreds of millions of dollars to reshape who is in Congress. And, that has really become a leading feature of how they operate. And, this is important heading into 2016 because, now they are once again poised to both defend, especially in the Senate, where there is a chance, it's a slim chance that the Democrats could capture a majority again. The chamber is looking to defend its friends there. It's also in a new kind of unique position this year where it's also having to defend its kind of pro-business friends in primaries where Republican candidates are now getting challenges from the right, from Tea Party candidates, from libertarians, from folks backed by groups like the Club for Growth and the Koch brothers, who are in fact to the right of the chamber's favorite candidates. So we can expect again, that the chamber says it's going to spend as much as $100 million this cycle as it has in previous cycles. And, it's a significant contributor to the attack ads that really, really drive elections in races that are very, very close between Democratic and Republican candidates.
How does the U.S. Chamber of Commerce differ from other trade groups, say, that represent business interests? The National Federation of Independent Business is one, the Business Roundtable is another, and the National Association of Manufacturers.
In some ways, they're quite similar, right? I mean, each of the organizations you mentioned is, it's a trade association representing businesses. They tend to be really fierce defenders of those businesses' prerogatives against all manner of really essential environmental, consumer, labor, other legislation and regulations that, has an impact on their bottom line. The Business Roundtable tends to be somewhat more forward-looking in what will actually build an economy into the future. For instance, unlike the chamber, which has gotten really rapidly involved in fighting the Obama administration's climate change regulations. So the EPA is looking to regulate power plants and taking other measures to really stop the proliferation of greenhouse gases to the extent they can. The chamber has been viciously on the attack, going to court, organizing numerous states to attack these regulations and demanding that these regulations be suspended. Business Roundtable doesn't get involved in those type of really extreme, I'd say almost ideological efforts to counter, regulations that are really just essential for the nation's and the world's prosperity at this point. The National Federation of Independent Businesses it represents mostly small businesses. It sometimes joins with the chamber in things such as this fight against President Obama's climate change regulations. And National Association of Manufacturers is what it sounds like, right? They represent manufacturers, but the groups will often team up with one another. But they're not involved. The other groups are not involved in electoral politics in any way. They are there as a kind of membership group, a support group, a lobbying group. The chamber is a very, very different animal. It is really there to push these multiple levers of power and really ensure that regulations objectionable to business don't have a way of seeing the light of day.
Alyssa Katz, you mentioned a moment ago that the chamber doesn't have to disclose who its contributors are, but in the course of this book, you have delved into who is funding the chamber. So what do we know in terms of the industries and even the particular companies that fund the chamber and whose interest the chamber is representing?
So technically speaking, the chamber's donors are all secret, right? This is a prerogative of any nonprofit to keep its donors secret. But once in a while, either through accidents or through leaks from the inside or through disclosures from the companies themselves or through other means, we begin to get a picture of some of the companies that are in fact funding the chamber. And I'll state the big picture first before we delve into the specifics of who those companies are. One recurring theme among these companies is that they are businesses that have really toxic problems. And I mean toxic in the literal sense, in that they are polluters or pose threats to human health or in some other way create kind of collateral damage or direct damage in the course of doing business that poses a real problem for them in the political arena, right? Because they're going to be the subjects of regulation, subjects of boycotts in some cases, or real pressure on their industries to cause less harm, or even, in the case of some, to scale back or go out of business entirely. And so they in effect hire the chamber. They don't just pay dues. They pay, make significant contributions to the chamber so that those groups can remain anonymous and conduct their lobbying with the friendly face of the Chamber of Commerce as their representative, with the chamber then saying, well, we are advocating on behalf of all businesses, never even mentioning who the donors are. And the best example of this is the tobacco industry, where for decades, the major tobacco companies, particularly Philip Morris, what they have done is hired the chamber to conduct lobbying campaigns against objectionable regulations. And in doing that, the tobacco companies kept their identities completely secret. The chamber went out to Congress. In one case, it was fighting a tobacco tax that was being proposed. And they said, the chamber's lobbyists said, this is terrible for business. What industry could be next? It could be alcohol. It could be gambling. We don't, as a organization of businesses, we find this tobacco tax objectionable. Never ever mentioning that tobacco interests were financing the whole thing, financing surveys the chamber was doing to back up its lobbying and so forth. And the members of Congress who were voting on this bill were none the wiser and ended up voting the proposal down. Or at least it never passed. So it's, so that's kind of the blueprint of how the chamber operates on behalf of these noxious industries. And we're now seeing exactly the same pattern unfolding with the coal industry, where, one can deduce based on which companies are represented on the Chamber of Commerce's board of directors. Also, like another coal company, one coal company recently in bankruptcy, had to disclose in its bankruptcy filings that it had made significant contributions to the Chamber of Commerce. And so you once again see numerous coal-related companies, which include Peabody Energy, American Electric Power. You have Union Pacific, which is a major coal transporter. And in fact, the CEO of the Chamber of Commerce is a board member of Union Pacific Railway. And Union Pacific makes significant contributions to the Chamber of Commerce. So you know, and there are a number of other coal-related companies that have had associations with the chamber. And so this is, you know, what is driving the chamber now to go on the warpath against President Obama's Clean Power Plan and other greenhouse gas regulations. And the chamber is out there saying this is essential for all business, all, you know, all of business and all of the American economy is threatened by these regulations, whereas the truth is that these clean power regulations, in fact, also open up entirely new areas of the economy in renewable and clean energy that, you know, just happen to compete with coal. And so the chamber is really misrepresenting the dynamic at work here, where, you know, they are saying this is just a total loss for the economy. And they're saying it because they're representing coal companies while not saying or disclosing that they're in fact representing coal companies. So tobacco and coal are the best examples, but you see this on and on with automotive companies that wanted to fight liability for, you know, harm done to consumers by faulty products, you know, insurance companies that had similar concerns about their liability and wanted to, you know, fight to make it much harder to file class action suits against companies that harm people. I mean, the list goes on and on, but it takes a lot of detective work to figure out exactly who is funding the chamber.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with investigative journalist Alyssa Katz about her book, The Influence Machine, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Corporate Capture of American Life. So you've just been discussing some of the corporations or some of the industries that contribute to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce anonymously. And I wanted to ask you, why is anonymity so significant in the story?
That's a great question. I mean, you know, look, these companies, whether they are companies retailing to consumers or companies that have shareholders to answer to or both, have to be extremely protective of their public images and of their reputations and of their markets. And if they were, in fact, out there on their own in the political arena demanding the things that the chamber is now demanding on their behalf, they would face enormous backlash that would really be a threat to their businesses. And, you know, you can just to take one example of, and this isn't even, I'm not even sure whether or not this company is a chamber member, but Target, the retailer, right after Citizens United, when the Supreme Court made way for super PACs, which, you know, while they allow for unlimited corporate contributions, super PACs also require disclosure of donors to the Federal Election Commission. That's part of the law, and the chamber, we should note, is doing a giant end run around even the loose rules of Citizens United by insisting on anonymity for its donors. But in this case, in I think it was 2010, Target happened to contribute to a super PAC that was supportive of a candidate in Minnesota, in its home state, who had made anti-gay statements and I believe had really proposed anti-gay actions. And so once consumers and LGBT activists realized that Target had made these contributions to this candidate, they rallied and threatened a boycott of Target unless Target withdrew its contributions to this candidate. So, you know, that was a lesson learned for Target, that you don't give money through a super PAC, even if you're a company, you know, that can now give unlimited money under Citizens United. What you want to do is go through the back door. You want to go through the dark money channels. And for American businesses, the chamber is the premier dark money channel. Your fingerprints aren't on it. You don't have to worry about boycotts or customer pushback or shareholder lawsuits. Because remember, shareholders can come back to a company. If a company is out there engaging in politically controversial or risky behavior, the shareholders could come back and say, look, you are destroying our shareholder value. And that could be the subject of litigation or other for the company. So there's on a number of fronts, companies need the anonymity, they need the secrecy. And the chamber raises hundreds of millions of dollars every year from those companies in order to provide that cover and secrecy they so desperately need.
Well, listeners might be asking themselves at this point, why isn't the U.S. Chamber of Commerce compelled by the IRS to disclose contributions?
Yeah, the Internal Revenue Service regulates the Chamber of Commerce. And I actually want to add a footnote here is that the whole type of organization that is now out there funneling dark money into elections in the hundreds of millions of dollars, the same organizations that the Koch brothers use and that so many other groups are using to do this end run around Citizens United disclosure rules. The chamber actually lobbied the IRS in 1913. So right when the whole modern tax system was born, the chamber said, we need special protections under this new Internal Revenue Service so that we can collect money from businesses and not worry about interference here and not worry about being taxed or having them disclosed. And that was right when the chamber was born 100 years ago. They gave birth to this whole concept that businesses should have a kind of safe space within the within the political arena and within the social arena to make their voices heard without interference. So the protections against disclosure apply to any nonprofit organization and always have. I will note that the state of California right now, Attorney General Kamala Harris is trying to require disclosure of nonprofit organizations. And not surprisingly, the groups that are using nonprofits as political weapons really improperly are fighting back and saying that she's abridging their First Amendment rights. But it's a really bold step for California to take. The chamber has made the argument, and all of the dark money groups that have followed have made the argument, that they have two arguments, actually. One argument is that their political spending is not, in fact, political, that this is what are called 501c4 or 501c6 social welfare or trade organizations, that they can educate the public and that this is part of their job, and that all those attack ads are merely educational, which is ridiculous, but they'd argue this for many years. In response to subsequent legal rulings that challenged the premise that certain of those ads were simply educational, the chamber and other groups had to switch gears in the past few years. And so now they are running much more what's called express advocacy, where now the attack ads will say, vote against this person, throw them out of office, or they'll sponsor ads that'll say, vote for this person. So now in most cases, the chamber is not even claiming that the ads are merely educational. What the dark money groups have been doing is saying that as long as they are not spending the majority of their money on politics, that they are not, in fact, political groups. And the IRS, unfortunately, has given them cover because its commissioner has also spoken along the same lines and said, well, as long as these groups are not spending most of their money on politics, they can do what they want. And unfortunately, what you're also seeing now is many groups, including the chamber, that are, you know, spending enormous sums on elections, and some groups which really clearly are only political machines, which, you know, the chamber, as we've discussed, does a lot more. What's happening is that watchdog groups are filing complaints with the Federal Election Commission and saying, you know, these are not nonprofit groups, these are political committees, and you need to go after them. And what's happening is the Federal Election Commission is saying, oh yeah, I guess you're right, those are political committees, but, you know, they were doing that, their campaign, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, and too late now, so we're not going to take any action against them. So you have both the Internal Revenue Service and the Federal Election Commission kind of paralyzed in the face of the dark money phenomenon. And it doesn't help, you know, that you have conservatives really fired up around, if you recall, this Tea Party scandal or faux scandal a couple of years ago, where supposedly the Internal Revenue Service, you know, went after nonprofits that had Tea Party in their names or some such in their names. And the political pushback against the IRS was so fierce that now the agency is just really afraid to regulate political activity because it's going to be in a giant, you know, if nothing else, you know, not only a political battle, but also a sort of giant free speech battle with the chamber and with the groups that have followed in its path of saying that they should have the freedom as nonprofit groups to say whatever they want, do whatever they want, take secret donations, and, you know, if it's, you know, political activity that they're engaged in, so be it. And it's just a complete abdication by the federal government of its responsibility to regulate political activity under the law.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the author of The Influence Machine, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Corporate Capture of American Life, published by Spiegel and Grau. Alyssa Katz is also the author of Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us, which we had the pleasure of interviewing her about on Against the Grain several years ago. She is a member of the editorial board of the New York Daily News. We are going to talk much more about the corporations and companies that are involved in the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and how the U.S. Chamber of Commerce serves their interests. But I wanted to ask you about the history of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce going back 100 years. How did it come to be formed?
So, you know, if you rewind to 1912 when the chamber came into being, you know, you had a moment in American history where business was, you know, often at war with itself. And in particularly around the tariff, around, you know, taxes on imports that, you know, essentially protected certain sectors of the American economy. And you know, this became a real kind of political problem because in session after session in Congress, you know, you had some momentum for reform. You actually had the investigative journalist Ida Tarbell, you know, who did, the history of Standard Oil, and she was like the big muckraker of that time. Mm-hmm. For her, these tariffs were like a huge scandal to expose, because what they essentially did was protected entire industries, and were basically a form of corporate welfare at that time, and often resulted from really corrupt entanglements with the members of Congress who would, you know, pass these or allow these tariffs to continue. And then meanwhile, you had other businesses that were being ruined because they couldn't compete on this unlevel playing field. And so, you know, President Taft in particular, you know, who was this, you know, he was a kind of mostly pro-business Republican, and he was kind of trying to tidy things up after President Roosevelt had really been quite critical of businesses in a lot of ways. You know, President Taft came in and told these warring businesses, look, you guys have to really figure out what it is that you want to do, because I can only act on business's behalf if I have some kind of coherent agenda from you guys. And so the initial game plan was, in fact, to have the newly formed Department of Commerce kind of have an advisory board of businesses to help instruct the federal government about how they would best be, you know, how they would best be regulated and how policy should look going forward. But the businesses didn't want that. They didn't want to be kind of the president's pets. They wanted the independence. And so Taft and they switched gears and said, okay, well, why don't, you know, we talk about having an independent chamber of commerce that would be, you know, in fact, they sought, the chamber sought a charter from Congress. Congress decided not to charter it formally. But it did, as I mentioned, the chamber got special protections from this new Internal Revenue Service to operate as neither really the private sector, not the public sector, but this entirely new kind of animal, which was this nonprofit trade organization that would combine the firepower of all American business. And so in doing that, you know, I talked about how President Taft was seeking consensus. I mean, the chamber really followed that kind of consensus building model for decades. The chamber was bound by bylaws and internal rules that were very clear that the chamber's actions could not benefit any particular business or sector, and that its decisions had to be made by majority vote, and that vote would have to go to the general membership. And, you know, what this meant in practice was that the chamber, you know, while it was certainly very, very active in things like pushing back against the New Deal, in fighting for what things like, you know, what became the Taft-Hartley Act to rein in strikes by organized labor, you know, there were, you know, you later had the chamber fighting to significantly reduce corporate taxes, which they partially won under President Reagan. So around these sort of big picture issues that crossed all of American business, you know, the chamber would pretty reliably be out there fighting, as one would expect. What you didn't have during this history, because it was really forbidden in the organization's very DNA, was the kind of advocacy we've been talking about on behalf of specific industries, specific interests, and really in opposition to other interests, to emerging sectors of the economy, such as green energy, that are really pose threats in significant ways to these legacy industries that really make up the bulk of, from what we can tell, the chamber's, you know, bigger.
So what changed in the 70s and 80s, and really especially the 90s, where the Chamber of Commerce reoriented itself?
Well, you had a watershed moment in 1993-94 around Clinton administration's efforts to get some form of universal health care. And believe it or not, the Chamber of Commerce in 1993 was really in favor of the Clinton health care plan. And quite simply because the status quo of employer-paid health insurance is very costly for American employers. And it functioned in a sense as a drag on their business if they're competing internationally against businesses from the vast majority of countries that have universal and usually state-sponsored health insurance. You know, the companies had to carry all those costs on their own budgets, and this was difficult for them. So, quite rightly, the chamber came out in favor of this plan. But you know, you have had for a long time, dating back to the McCarthy era, and likely dating before, real kind of ideological faction in part on the chamber's board, in part on the chamber's staff, and also just in Washington, that simply sees any kind of strong government program to advance public interest, even in partnership with business, even when it's beneficial to business, that simply on an ideological basis cannot accept that and finds that anathema to the environment that they believe American business should operate in. And so what you saw was an enormous lobbying campaign, a really vicious bunch of threats and fights. You had, in Congress, John Boehner and Newt Gingrich and others really warned the chamber that they were not going to have them as friends in Congress anymore if they went ahead and continued to support Clinton's healthcare plan. And you know, in the end, the chamber was forced to flip its position from support of Clinton's plan to opposition, like literally overnight. They showed up, they had a lobbyist show up in Congress to testify, and he had to explain why they had changed their position, and he really couldn't. And shortly thereafter, the longtime president of the chamber, a man named Richard Lesher, resigned. And this big fight was a real trauma for the organization, and it led to a lot of reckoning on the board of directors about what it was going to be. And you had that board really decide at that point to just go whole hog and push the group in the kind of more ideological direction that was represented by this reversal of position on Clinton's healthcare plan. And so, you know, the new director of the chamber, the new CEO who came on in 1997 was a man named Tom Donahue, who had in fact worked for the chamber earlier in his career, starting up its kind of faux grassroots wing called Citizens' Choice that was out there to kind of generate letter writing campaigns and such on behalf of the chamber's lobbying agenda. They brought him back from the trucking industry lobbying group to run the chamber, and he came in there with a real a game plan to not only be, I mean, you know, Washington has plenty of conservative think tanks that were capable of putting out policy positions and so forth. But what he wanted to do was combine that ideology of minimal regulation on business with a extremely strategic political plan to actually realize that agenda. And then promptly went out and began to go to major business leaders and to go to their lobbyists in Washington and say, that old Chamber of Commerce used to reluctantly write checks to and pay dues to, that's all gone. This new Chamber of Commerce is going to be a fierce advocate on your behalf. I want you to step up your donations to us. And in return, we can promise you we're going to deliver an entirely different regulatory environment in Washington. Donahue came in determined to significantly increase the chamber's budget and resources and to put those resources into really supersizing all the stuff we talked about, the elections spending, the lobbying, the litigation, and to really build up capacity in each of those areas in an incredibly strategic way. And so really everything I write about in the book about the modern chamber since 1997 is really attributable to CEO Tom Donahue and to several of his deputies as well, who were really instrumental in building up this strategic team that could really be deployed on behalf of any corporation that wanted to hire it.
Okay, so you write, Alyssa Katz, in The Influence Machine, that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce reoriented itself in many ways in response to the legacy of the 1960s, the kind of consumer protections and regulations. There was a turn starting in the 1970s within the business class towards a more aggressive pro-corporate agenda, you know, that can be termed neoliberalism, amongst other things. And that push really ratcheted up in the 1980s. So it's interesting to me that the Chamber of Commerce took on its particularly aggressive nature, not then, but in the late 90s. Would you just attribute this to the kind of ideological orientation of Tom Donahue as the president and CEO at that time? Or could one see a larger need within the business class, a sense that an even more aggressive orientation was necessary?
Yeah, I think that, you know, organizing for mutual benefit doesn't necessarily come naturally to businesses, right? They are by their nature competitive. And we also, for very good reasons, have laws in this country that prevent cartels, collusion, you know, really the kind of business collaboration that would really pose an even greater threat to democracy than the Chamber of Commerce. So, you know, I think part of this is just, it's, you know, you have individual companies focused on their bottom lines, focused on their growth, that are just slow to react to a changing environment. And you also, you know, we can't underestimate how kind of catalyzing these 1960s movements were. I mean, it was, you really had a sense in Washington that, you know, the consumer groups, the labor groups, the environmentalists, really, you know, they were the big powers in a very real sense. And business didn't quite have a clue at that point and didn't have the leadership at that point to really effectively counter it. No, so I think you had one turning point when President Reagan came into office. But then, of course, the problem is that when you have a pro-business, let's cut taxes and or not cut taxes later on, president, it was very hard for the chamber, for one, or for any other group, to go out with a tin cup to businesses and say, actually, we're under terrible threat here. You should join the chamber and we're going to go out there and, you know, do something about the business climate, because they had a very friendly business climate with Reagan in the White House. So I think part of it was you know, Bill Clinton's arrival. And, you know, Clinton had the real chutzpah, right, to put out this premise that businesses could win and the public could win. And this was true certainly in his healthcare plan. It was true as well in ways that I documented in my first book of what he was trying to do with promoting home ownership, building up the housing sector and the mortgage industry and so forth, while helping American households amass their own wealth was the premise. And that's how Clinton operated consistently. And, you know, I think it's having Clinton in the White House so successfully, you know, businesses prospering under that success. But I think also realizing at that point that they were leaving a lot of money on the table, right? That every time Clinton would promote one of these policies that would give a little to business and take something back for the public, that the business's point of view was, well, why can't we have it all? Why do we have to have a give and take? And so I think it was just the sort of right political moment for the chamber to assert itself in the way that it did. And it was just also that, you know, you had that trauma of the healthcare fight that opened the way for, you know, Donahue was just the leader to make that happen and to change that ideological orientation and to really whip those businesses into this collaborative project that they, I don't think, would ever have taken on left to their own devices.
That is the voice of Alyssa Katz. She is the author of The Influence Machine, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Corporate Capture of American Life. That's published by Spiegel and Grau, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. She's an investigative journalist, and you're listening to Against the Grain, and I'm Sasha Lilly. So I want to ask you, Alyssa, more about some specific examples of the kind of influence the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has had on policy, on laws. And I wonder if you could tell us about its impact on the category, if you will, of environmental health, the kind of things that industry may produce that directly have an impact on, you know, the air we breathe or the water we drink.
Sure. I mean, you know, the chamber has really grown into the leading business voice in opposition to the signature efforts of the Obama administration to keep air and water clean. And they're in fact involved in two major court fights right now over one thing is called the Waters of the U.S. plan, which is meant to reassert a former federal authority over rivers and streams and so forth that go into national waterways like Chesapeake Bay, Puget Sound, where you have kind of significant wildlife and environmental resources in jeopardy there, you know, because you have pollutants running into those waterways from tributaries. And so this is a really important effort to try to establish some federal oversight over that. The chamber has rallied, it has gone to court, rallied states, and been a leading voice in fighting those regulations and saying that those are overreach when, you know, as I said, this is just reasserting authority that the federal government already had. You also have the chamber as the organizer of an effort that involves, at this point, 26 states to fight Obama's Clean Power Plan, which would establish a cap and trade system that would essentially force states to scale down their use of coal-fired power plants and scale up their use of natural gas and renewable energy. And, you know, it allows states to figure out their own path to doing this. And the chamber has fought back, is looking to block this regulation now, and is saying that this is just an enormous threat to the American economy and to the coal business, and they are demanding that this be stopped. And this is a pattern the chamber is engaged in for a very long time. I mean, the group has not only fought these kinds of regulations in the past, as I write about in The Influence Machine, the chamber has also sought to kind of develop new ways to challenge this kind of environmental regulation on the basis of technicalities and finding ways to challenge the well-established science that underlies these regulations. You know, you had clean air regulations that sought to limit asthma-causing pollutants in exhaust from diesel and other sources. The chamber pushed a law that's still on the books that allows for the scientific research underlying the regulations to be challenged. And, you know, what they sought was, you know, this is a well-respected, heavily cited Harvard study about the impact of dirty air on the public, and, you know, really laid out what the health and death toll is from these pollutants when they're not properly regulated. The chamber hounded the researchers who produced this study for the data, and then attempted to use this law that it had promulgated, you know, through Congress to actually challenge the science underlying these clean air regulations. So, you know, again, going back to what we were talking about earlier, this is where the chambers reach into all of these different power arenas become so important. Because not only was the chamber out there lobbying to influence members of Congress on these issues, and not only was the chamber involved in the regulatory process to object to the EPA's you know, regulating pollutants as it's entitled to under the Clean Air Act, but then the chamber was also passing, you know, urging members of Congress to pass other laws that would enable it to then go to court and then challenge those regulations on technicalities that it itself had created. And so you're seeing this sort of incredibly strategic use of these multiple levers of power in coordination with one another. Sometimes these strategies work, sometimes they don't, but the pattern of fighting these regulations that are simply seek to protect public health under well-established law and science is consistent. And this is what the chamber has done again and again and again.
What about class action lawsuits, which has been one vehicle through which people who have been exposed, say, to toxics have been able to demand some kind of accountability or at least compensation from the industries or corporations?
Right. So the chamber engaged, you know, through its Institute for Legal Reform. It raised a lot of money, mostly from insurance companies. State Farm was a big one, Prudential, AIG were some of the big players in this. And it raised a significant amount of money to try to change the climate for consumers out there in the courts when they seek to sue after, you know, being harmed by a product. And they particularly targeted states where they perceive judges and juries to be overly favorable to consumers and to lead to very, very expensive payouts to consumers from those companies based on jury rulings. And, you know, some of these payouts were significant amounts of money, but it was because these companies had harmed so many people. I mean, you're talking about class action suits, for instance, on behalf of everyone who had ever had their auto parts replaced under a State Farm claim, who, you know, these people all had got fake parts put in their cars by the insurer when they were being told that these were actually authorized auto parts. And these fake parts were not, you know, they were not the same as the parts that they were replacing. And, you know, the liability adds up very quickly when you're a company that's doing things like that to rip off consumers. So the chamber in that particular instance engaged in some real chicanery around the court that was poised to sign off on that particular settlement. It actually went in, this was in Illinois in 2004, the court had ruled that the company, that State Farm was liable. It had only it was only a matter of signing off on what was going to be a $1 billion settlement. The chamber ended up funneling millions and millions of dollars into a political campaign to toss out the judge on the panel in Illinois who were perceived to be favorable to to consumers and was going to sign off on this $1 billion settlement and made sure to install a pro-business judge who could be relied on to reject the settlement, even though there were signs that he actually had improper ties to the parties in the litigation and was had a conflict of interest and should not have been voting on this. He nonetheless got elected with the chamber's help and with the help of other other outside funders, and then promptly voted down the settlement and it ended up being significantly reduced. So, you know, you have a chamber involved not just in Illinois, but in many, many states to actually get rid of judges on the bench who are perceived to be too consumer friendly, replace them with friendlier judges. And then it also helped advance federal legislation that removed a lot of class action cases from state courts that were perceived to be consumer friendly and put them into federal courts where they could be assured of consistently smaller smaller judgments. So, you know, and the other thing the chamber has been doing is promoting the use of mandatory arbitration in consumer contracts, and now is working to block some very important efforts emerging from the Obama administration to rein in this mandatory arbitration. And mandatory arbitration is simply that when you sign a contract for a cell phone or when you send your parent to a nursing home and sign up there, a number of consumer contracts will actually say that you are required to resolve any disputes through a private forum. You cannot go to court or, you know, or join a class action suit to resolve these grievances. And these forums are overwhelmingly stacked against consumers because the arbitrators who are doing these cases, they're counting on the companies to steer them business. And they know that if they rule unfavorably for the companies, that they are not going to get more jobs as arbitrators. So, you know, you have consumers coming into these situations with the odds against them. The chamber has gone out there and said, well, our arbitration is actually great for consumers. It's better for consumers, which is a ridiculous argument to make because if arbitration is so great for consumers, then it should be consumers' choice, right? I mean, if the chamber supports free markets and the notion that people should decide what services to use or what products to buy, then by all means, if consumers want to opt into arbitration in their contracts, they should. But to actually mandate that arbitration and then claim that it's good for consumers just is doesn't wash at all.
I'm afraid we're entirely out of time. I've been speaking with Alyssa Katz. She's an investigative journalist, member of the editorial board of the New York Daily News. She is author of the book, The Influence Machine, The U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Corporate Capture of American Life, published by Spiegel and Grau. We've been discussing that book today. Also the author of Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us. Alyssa Katz, thank you.
Thank you. This is great.
And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap. You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.